So you've turned to Free Radio here. This is 101.3 FM. I'm Robert, and this is Bathrop Spears Broadside Sunday Morning Show. Today is, of course, the 7th of October. The infamous Columbus Day is coming over the horizon on Monday. Less said about that, better. I call it Native American Slaughter Day, since the Arawak Indians felt the genocidal touch of the great explorer and his brother and all the other conquistadors and bureaucrats he brought over to loot the country and Christianize the country. As I mentioned before, in about 10 minutes I'll be having on the air, hopefully, Mike Millen, who's an attorney who took a case on contingency for the preacher William Hampsmeyer, who I haven't ever spoken to, I don't think. Or if I did, I may have talked to him briefly back in 2010, but don't have a particular memory of that. And I think I probably would if he was busted on the street. Maybe that was on Pacific Avenue, or he received a ticket for unreasonably disturbing noise, which 2 years and some months later, the courts threw out. And not only did they throw out, actually the ticket was never taken to court, but the entire law was thrown out, and it's coming up again at the city council, a revised version, so that they give the police the tools to shut down any performer they want to who displeases a member of the public, or a resident, or a merchant. They're all members of the public, but of course they're parts of special interest groups that seem to be running the city. And I'm going to talk to him about this upcoming ordinance and about his own experiences with civil liberties and the particular difficulties that a person has getting an attorney to raise these issues in court. I mean, Santa Cruz has some of the most restrictive laws, ordinances by the city council they're for everybody, but of course they're selectively used against poor and homeless people and probably people of color. Again, don't have a lot of stats on that. You raise the issue and you hear this shriek of horror from the city council and the police department as though that can't be so, when in fact if you talk to people in the African-American community, you find that they tend to believe it is so. I know, they're just paranoid. I have been taking reports over the years. I don't have a lot of contact with, usually with Latino and African-American folks, unless they happen to be downtown, and that happens, you know. But I do occasionally stray from my honky land, so to speak, and it's my general impression that we, like everywhere else, are steeped in racism and it's a conditioning. It's not something that people necessarily choose, but it's something that, unless they actively fight it, they are likely to be guided by it. That's the problem, myself included. So I don't know if William Hampsmeyer, the preacher who succeeded in giving the street performers of Santa Cruz at least a couple of months' respite from these ordinances, because even if the ordinance passes at the Tuesday afternoon city council meeting, the revised ordinance, there's still no ordinance, and there won't be one in place, as I understand it, until 1 month after the second reading, which will be 2 weeks after this Tuesday. So there's about a six-week period here when there's going to be police officers are just going to not know what to do with themselves if they find a street performer who somebody complains about because they don't like the way he sounds. I guess they can use the also unconstitutional and also relatively unprecedented move-along law, which requires anybody with a table, a cup, a guitar case, anything capable of holding tangible things, is the peculiar wording of the ordinance, to move along after an hour at least 100 feet and not come back to that spot for 24 hours. There are ways around that if you look at the careful wording of the ordinance. But you have to be willing to deal with the police, you have to be willing to deal with potential tickets, you have to be willing to deal with courts that are not only pro-police, but seem to be virulently anti-homeless and anti-street people and anti-activist. At least that was my experience in my unreasonably disturbing noise case, which I was convicted on, I guess, 2 years ago for singing the song Downtown with homeless lyrics in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. not on the complaint of Ryan Coonerty, whose family owns the bookshop and who was the mayor at the time, but on the complaint of Sean Riley, who was a resident who wanted to sleep during the day, during the hour and a half when we had our... We had a petitioning, we had a flyering, we had a little bit of music and singing in front of the bookshop, where apparently he has a room on the second story. But this, you know, this is going to be at least a brief pause in the, at least in the enforcing of that ordinance, which I'm going to be asking him whether other cities have similar ordinances. And one thing I did try to do is, at the suggestion of an Occupy Santa Cruz activist, who probably prefers to remain anonymous. She's very modest, but also a very hard worker, does a lot of research on issues like this. She was hoping we could propose an alternate ordinance to the city council that they would put into place that was less onerous and provided for free speech and allowed for everybody's rights to be respected. So if performers performing very loudly, I mean, the obvious thing to do is for the person to come down and ask them, can you keep it down a little bit? I'm trying to, I don't know, do my tax returns or sell knickknacks to this group of out-of-towners or sleep during the day, whatever I'm trying to do. And that wasn't done in my case, by the way. In the case of my case and the other people who were cited and arrested in front of the bookshop, non-custodially arrested. We weren't taken into custody. We were ticketed with $450 tickets, and the city then essentially backed the trial on the other side. It didn't, the police didn't, the city wasn't accusing it as a crime. It was the citizen who was, but this is a new process, or actually not a new process, but a much more expedited and toxic process that's being used downtown. Citizens, or ordinary people, mostly of the gentrified sort, are given really preferential treatment by police in any complaints they make. And so it doesn't look like a police attack on the homeless. Oh, we're just, you know, we're neutral. We're passing on tickets. But the issue for a person who's playing a guitar downtown or singing or preaching or giving a political speech, making any kind of noise, as the ordinance puts it, communicating any kind of message or just humming, is how loud can I be without being against the law? And the ordinance doesn't really tell you that. I've talked about the ordinance before, and I'll be reading it in a moment. But it has to do with very subjective criteria that even the police department does not have any notion of. Even a complainant doesn't have any notion of how loud you can be, because the ordinance itself, as you will hear, and as I've read before, has a very subjective standard. And it's indeed, it is so subjective that we had thought it was, you know, completely unconstitutional. And it was ruled unconstitutional, but not for the reasons we thought. That was the strange thing. And I talked about this last show, and we're going to have, hopefully, Mike talking about this as well when he comes on the air. Let's see if I can find the appropriate... Becky Johnson does a very good and very colorful treatment of this subject on her website, Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking. And you can find a lot of interesting articles there. I recommend you check them out. You don't have to agree with everything she believes on every subject, but I think she is really right on a number of these subjects, and we've been working together for years on this stuff. So let's see what we got here. I've had a little trouble with finding this the other day, and I'm still having a little difficulty. Let's see here. I used to carry this ordinance around in my pocket because the wording is so arcane that it is hard to... It is hard to even paraphrase it. That's the problem. There's a, if you want to catch the lyrics of the song that we were arrested for singing, you can. It's also on her website, Downtown. Just Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking, .blogspot.com, and then search for Downtown. You know, it's pretty, you know, pretty Santa Cruz specific lyrics. When you stand up for the wretched and homeless, cops will drag you down. Downtown, they'll tell you shut up or face the weekend in lockup, because the merchants own downtown. Yet you may find somebody poor like you to understand you, someone who is getting screwed and needs a helping hand to stand and be strong. So maybe we'll face them there. We'll stand up to the bullshit. Let bullies beware. When we're downtown, things will be real. When we're downtown, don't let them steal our rights. Downtown, let's stand together and fight. By the which I mean struggle to maintain your rights. And there's 9 or 10 verses to this song. And we, it's been kind of traditional. We've sung this song with different lyrics over the years at that spot. Maybe we'll be doing it again. We did it again, actually, even after the ordinance, even after we were convicted and the ordinance was still standing. So we'll see if we can get some authoritative thoughts on that subject. And in the meantime, I'm going to take a brief musical break. Don't go away, because we're hopefully going to have some real expertise today. And if not, you'll always have me, and hopefully I'll always have you, or at least for the next 2 hours. Call-in number here is 427-3772 and 469-3119. Try the 469-3119 number today, because I'm trying to catch this, hoping that our man from, I guess he's calling in from Los Gatos, always confuse Los Gatos and Los Altos and all those other places there, but let's hope.
In Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. Made their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon, and we've moved on to the electric chair. And I wonder who's gonna be president, Tweedledum or Tweedledummer, and who's gonna have the big blockbuster box office this summer. Maybe we could put up a wall between the houses and the highway, and then you could go your way and I could go my way. With all the TVs and the magazines agree with all the radios, and I keep hearing that same damn song everywhere I go, everywhere I go. Maybe I should put a bucket over my head and a marshmallow in each ear and stumble around for another dum-dum week for another humdrum hit song to appear. As in a record of an event, the event of people playing music in a room. Now everything is cross-marketing. It's about sunglasses and shoes or guns and drugs. You choose. We got it rehashed. We got it half-assed. We're digging up all the graves and we're spitting on the past. And we can choose between the colors of the lipstick on the horse, because we know the difference between the font of 20% more and the font of teriyaki. You tell me, how does it make you feel? You tell me, you tell me, you tell me what's real. And they say that alcoholics are always alcoholics, even when they're dry as my lips for years. Even when they're stranded on a small desert island with no place in 2,000 miles to buy beer. And I wonder, is he different? Is he different? Has he changed what he's about? Or is he just a liar with nothing to lie about? Am I headed for the same bridge? Is there anything I can do about anything at all except go back to that corner in Manhattan and dig deeper this time? Down beneath the impossible pain of our history, beneath unknown bones, beneath the bedrock of the mystery, the sewage system and the salt train, beneath the cornerstones and the path train, beneath the record of friendships and street deals, beneath the screeching of kamikaze cab wheels, beneath everything I can think of to think about, beneath all, get out, beneath the good and the kind and the stupid and the cruel, there's a fire that's just waiting for fuel. I'm just going to play you one more little song and we'll get on with it. But our Father, who art in a penthouse, sits in his 37th floor suite and swivels to gaze down at the city he made me in. He allows me to stand and solicit graffiti until he needs the land I stand on. And I, in my darkened threshold, am pawing through my pockets the receipts, the bus schedules, the urgent napkin poems, and matchbook phone numbers, all of which laundering has rendered pulpy and strange. Loose change and a key, ask me. Go ahead. Ask me if I care. I got the answer here. I wrote it down somewhere. I just gotta find it. And somebody in their spray paint got too close. Somebody came on too heavy. Now look at me, made ugly by the drooling letters. I was better off alone. Ain't that the way it is? They don't know the first thing, but you don't know that till they take the first swing. My fingers are red and swollen from the cold. I'm getting bold in my old age, so go ahead. Try the door. It doesn't matter anymore. I know the weak-hearted are strong-willed and we're being kept alive until we're killed. He's up there. The ice is clinking in his glass. He sends us little pieces of paper. I don't ask. I just empty my pockets and wait. It's not fate. It's just circumstance. I don't fool myself with romance. I just live phone number to phone number, dusting them against my thighs and the warmth of my pockets, which whisper history incessantly, asking me, where were you? I lower my eyes, wishing I could cry more and care less. Yes, it's true, I was trying to love someone again. I was caught caring, bearing weight. But I love this city, this state. This country is too large, and who's ever in charge of there better take the elevator down and put more than change in our cup, or else we are coming.
Yeah, that was two more by Annie DeFranco. They were called Fuel and Coming Up. So, well, while I'm waiting for this hopeful call-in, I will remind you what we're going to be talking about, and I'll just kind of do a brief update on this, hopefully brief, in the event that I don't get this call-in, which could happen, I suppose. The actual ordinance itself, which I've read before, here, but in which I've actually finally tracked down, reads as follows. This is the ordinance that was thrown out by the court. No person shall make, cause, suffer, or permit to be made any noises or sounds, A, which are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or which are so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural or unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person, and B, which are not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully conducted. That last phrase, which are not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully conducted, was the reason the law was thrown out by Judge White in the Hampsmeyer case. Because, according to Judge White, and I think he's correct, who could figure out what is necessary to an activity otherwise lawfully conducted? The activity that we, singers and petitioners and speakers downtown in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, talking about the homeless death rate way back in January of 2010, what we were doing, the lawful activity that we were doing, was engaging in First Amendment petitioning of the mayor, who His family owns the bookshop and was frequently there, and otherwise was very inaccessible and still is as a council member, as far as I know. Luckily, he is an outgoing council member who will be gone in about a month. And of course, we'll probably get somebody worse, but let's not get into that. In any case, was the singing that we were doing necessary in connection with the activity which was otherwise lawfully conducted? It's obviously lawful to set up a table and petition on Pacific Avenue, even if somebody upstairs doesn't like it because they're trying to sleep. Unless, you know, you are truly creating noise that is, I would say, physically disturbing. And by the way, there are always exceptions in the ordinance, and that's another section of the ordinance for city-sponsored noise of a different kind. So it does give an exception to city workers and so forth. But for those who are, the problem we had was not we want to have carte blanche or any loud screaming or, you know, extremely loud instrument playing person downtown to blow his trumpet at 3 in the morning, although this ordinance only takes precedence and only actually applies during the day. But we wanted to know, to stop police from simply using this ordinance to run off any street performer that a resident said, I don't like the sound of. Because they would use this. That was the problem we had. So we wanted to ask, just how loud can you be? And of course they couldn't tell us, but we were convicted anyway. And it looks like we got a caller here. And hello, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, hey, Robert. Whenever you're talking about noise ordinance, I always mention San Mateo. And I have their noise ordinance up here right now.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And it starts out and it talks about definitions. It says, sound level expressed in decibels means a logarithmic indication of the ratio between the acoustic energy present at a given location. And so on. It goes on like that. In other words, it's based on science. And they have a machine that measures the decibels. And so their noise ordinance is not vague like Santa Cruz. It's, you know, it's something in particular.
Yeah, it would be interesting to...
Yeah, when your lawyer friend calls in, ask him about that, too.
Yeah, if he does, that would be great. It would be interesting to look at the actual San Mateo situation for street performers. I suspect they have less street performers than here, though I haven't spent much time in San Mateo. It's a larger city. It's kind of more conservative and upscale, I think, but I'm not really that conversant with it. But
yeah,
I've
never seen any street performers in San Mateo.
Yeah, you know, but if... Are you from San Mateo yourself?
No, I hardly ever go there, but occasionally I have a job there.
I went there to a court once, I think, for a speeding ticket decades ago.
Oh, right, yes.
But, you know, the interesting thing would be if this ordinance in San Mateo were in place down here, then what we asked this officer who came by and told us to move, stop playing or else get a ticket, and she wouldn't be giving it to us, but the citizen, but she would be facilitating the citizen giving us the ticket. If we had had this ordinance in place, we could have said, okay, well, how loud can we play? And show me your decibel meter. We can, you know, we can see how loud we can be without creating a problem. Then we can decide if that is, are to us, unreasonable. And if it's unreasonably quiet, we
and
want to be,
would...
you know, then we might violate the law intentionally, but because it, you know, we just need to know what the level is, and of course, we don't have that here. So,
right, that would be reasonable, and that would make sense.
And that's not what is being proposed at the City Council on Tuesday. The City Council is simply proposing the same ordinance minus that last phrase. So now you can't even get an exemption if you're doing it, if it's in connection with an activity which is lawfully conducted. You are not going to be able to do it. It's only going to be if you're making noise which is unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying or so harsh, prolonged, or unnatural, unusual. Those phrases are going to be the basis on which a judge supposedly will make, because you don't get a jury, this is an infraction case, you know, we'll make that decision. And I have not heard of an unreasonably disturbing noise case being thrown out by a local judge yet. And I would like to hear that, but I'm afraid that they're not likely to do that, or at least they haven't been so far.
Well, the local judiciary seems to be on board with the repression.
I wasn't that surprised because I've gotten kind of cynical over the years, but I will read a bit of the verdict of the judge just to remind people of the kind of
situation we're likely to face in the future under this new ordinance. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Robert. Bye.
You got more info, call in again, though, please.
So, yeah, do call in. 469-3119 is the number to call as I continue to leave the other line open in hopes of getting a phone call from our legal friend. The actual... Here is Becky Johnson's description of our case. And I know a lot of people have heard of this before and they have a sense of it, but she writes very well about it. And the case is just a typical example, I think, of the way police behave downtown. If you don't do what they say, they will give you a ticket. It doesn't matter if what they say is constitutional or legal, they'll give you a ticket. Unless they have a sense that there are people videoing, that there's going to be some support, or unless they're bluffing and they simply want to push you along, and if you don't behave, well, they'll try something else or they'll ignore it until there's more and more pressure on them to act otherwise by some merchants who want this or that. But again, the purpose that HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group that was tabling, wanted to put up here, was pressing forward on, was support for street performers. We knew and know that this is, I haven't got a lot of reports from street performers. There aren't many. Well, last night there certainly weren't many street performers. There was one guy, there were two people with guitars. One guy was on a bench, and then there was the irrepressible Ricardo Lopez, who can't be driven away with camping tickets or any other kind of tickets in front of the New Leaf Market. He's a survivor and he's a fighter. So, but generally speaking, on Saturday night I expect to see, particularly such a balmy Saturday night, a lot of performers. Nobody else that I saw. So, and you've heard in interviews, and so have I on this show, that street performers have been, once they're threatened with tickets or given tickets, they just don't come back. At least many of them don't. And the performers that I see downtown are new performers, or they're very conventional. Like once a week we come down with our little family group and perform. And, that's nice. And no problem. But the idea of performers who do so because they need to, because they're making a living that way, are performers who are struggling to kind of better what they do. They're not so good to begin with, but they improve. They have a real connection, because people are performing on the street have to have a connection with the community in some way. They're out there in ways that most of us are apprehensive about being out there. So, here's a story by Becky Johnson about her, about this case, I think she wrote the story before there was a trial. Yeah, this story was written actually, I think, a day or two after the actual ticketing. And it's, if you want to check it out, it's Sing a Song, Go to Jail. And, of course, nobody was arrested, but $450 is a pretty stiff fine for singing a political song downtown that disturbs a day sleeper. And that, of course, was the issue for a lot of us. And they called several cops. Officer Schoenfeld was the officer who did most of the dirty work, and she got backed up by Officer Inouye, who refused to take our counter-complaint, that the complaint against us was false, that there was a false police report. So not only were the police siding with the other side, because they didn't hear, they weren't going to testify that the noise was unreasonably disturbing. Even though Schoenfeld had walked by, we asked her, can you tell us, how loud noise should be? And she wouldn't. She couldn't. She said she didn't know, and that wasn't her job, and blah, blah. But it is our job, her job to drive us away, which, of course, it is. So she was being quite honest in this peculiar way. So here's the story as Becky Johnson describes it. They say that Let It Snow, one of the most popular Christmas songs in American history, was written by two Jews during a record heat wave in Hollywood and doesn't mention Christmas at all. Likewise, when a few HUF members decided to sing a new song to us anyway, the sun was shining brightly and folks were walking along Pacific Avenue in T-shirts. Yet in a town actually called the Leftmost City, two Santa Cruz police officers were chilling freedom of speech by issuing four $445 tickets to four people singing Let It Snow. Actually sang a number of things. That was the actual song that was sung when the tickets were issued. SCPD Officer Schoenfeld, 159, interrupted our first attempt to let it snow and told us she'd received a complaint of excessive noise. They're happy with you protesting. They just said you were a little loud. They're willing to sign a citation. I'd rather not do that. Since we were in one of two free speech zones on Pacific Avenue, one of them is in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, and I believe the other is in front of O'Neill's, where you're allowed to set up a table within 10 feet of a sculpture. That's the great free speech, I guess, access you get that has essentially excluded setting up tables or sitting down on 95% of the sidewalk. I think it's, you can't sit within 95% of the downtown sidewalks, and you can't set up a table within, I think, 80%. And it really crowds people into into smaller spaces and gives police real license to drive people along. Since we were in one of the two free speech zones on Pacific Avenue, not playing amplified music, which requires a permit, singing and engaged in First Amendment activities, and hadn't been very loud, the charge seemed odd. Of course, in America, any citizen can sue anyone about anything, or so we're told. But this isn't a lawsuit. This is actually a criminal charge, and the police officer really is obliged to determine if there is probable cause there. And if not, the police officer can either take a report to forward to the DA, can tell the individual concerned to take the matter and prosecute it civilly if she or he wants. But that wasn't the action. This was an immediate coming down on the side of the complainant, in this case, Sean O'Reilly, who was the individual living above. An elderly couple are in one of the apartments upstairs, and they're trying to take a nap, and they say you've been playing for about 4 hours. My obligation is to write a ticket if someone makes a complaint, we were told. I'm here to try to inform you that someone is complaining. These are verbatim quotes by Becky Johnson. I think she got them from the videotape or from the tape recording that we made of this. We had a tape recording of the entire interaction. It wasn't an elderly couple. It was one person. It was this, I would say, hostile and possibly mendacious individual, Sean O'Reilly, who decided, instead of coming down and asking us to be quiet, he was trying to sleep or to be quieter, he called the police. He also, when he claimed we'd been there for 4 hours, it simply wasn't true. We got there an hour and a half before, and we were engaging in political activity. Some of it might have been, you know, shouted out, which isn't illegal at all. But the police were treating it as illegal because they said it came from a private complaint and had to do with unreasonably disturbing noise. Convenient for them. I couldn't even hear from across the street, said Valerie Promis, a local street singer associated with SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom of Expression, who had chanced by our event and had joined us in singing Let It Snow when Officer Schoenfeld walked up. Valerie was not sighted. They went after myself, Becky Johnson, the late Robert Blindbear Facer, and Michelle, a nearby person who wasn't even there. She just walked up and wondered what was going on, but she was simply sighted improperly. Charges were dropped against her later, but she lost time going to court, put through considerable anxiety. Of course, all the rest of us were dragged to court for hours and hours, the longest infraction trial ever. A somewhat lengthy discussion took place, which resulted in Officer Schoenfeld revealing that she really expected us to pack up and go away based on the warning enforced by her threat of citation. That, of course, is the key. That's what we were trying to say. No, you can't do that. Stop doing that to us and to other performers downtown. And we found that the judge is perfectly happy with that kind of process, even though she didn't explicitly say so when she found me guilty. We understood her warning to be about excessive noise and not our presence with the Huff table. Our petitioning effort, three petitions, including one about police harassment, were on the table, and are giving away a pot of hot, tasty soup to many hungry and grateful recipients. Our theme that day was unsafe to be homeless in Santa Cruz, which was chosen after a record number of annual homeless deaths, 47 have been reported the previous month. Vice Mayor Ryan Coonerty formed a downtown task force along with Council Members Robinson and Matthews in the spring of 2007, which privately met with business owners, members of the Downtown Association, and agents from the Redevelopment Agency and the Police Department to teach citizens how to call police to enforce minor violations against people they didn't like. Ryan's committee completely bypassed the Downtown Commission, an indication of things to come. Had Ryan Coonerty met with the complainant before he left the building? Did he speak to the Schoenfeld before she came to warn us? Ryan was seen exiting Bookshop Santa Cruz less than 10 minutes before Officer Schoenfeld arrived. I don't think necessarily had anything to do with it. But he certainly didn't speak out against this and when he took it to city council, the closed session, and said, don't waste city money backing this prosecution. If Sean O'Reilly, the complainant, wants to take this case to court, let him do so himself. But no, he had the city attorney on his side hour after hour. I would say, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dollars were spent on this case by the city. Huff members milled while Schoenfeld, now joined by Officer Inouye, questioned witnesses, only to be confronted by a man on a bicycle, Ian, who stopped to jeer at us loudly. A woman leaned out of the upper window and yelled things at us, so people started to yell back at her, and a noisy dialogue ensued, far louder than any noise our tabling event had produced earlier. She openly videotaped us as well. Meanwhile, the complainant, Sean Riley, came down to fill out his complaint. As I took his photo, he gave me the finger right in front of Officer Schoenfeld. She ignored him. They've been here for 3 hours, Riley told Schoenfeld. He later amended that to make it 4 hours. This was about 3 p.m. and didn't sync with when our first Huff member arrived at 1:30 p.m. to pick up the soup or the publicized time of our event. I myself arrived at 2:30 and only sang 1.5 songs. In all, I maybe sang for about 15 minutes. We had no amplification. And other than our singing, the only sounds were made with Blind Bear's little drum and Coral's keyboard, an instrument she has played on Pacific Avenue for 5 years. Some people would consider that amplified, and perhaps they would. Officer Schoenfeld certainly didn't, because she didn't write us a ticket for that or didn't in any way caution us or mention it was a problem. Yet despite that, we had stopped singing when Schoenfeld interrupted us. We had not started singing again. She inexplicably decided to write us citations anyway. Robert Blind Bear Facer, who was cited, did not sing a word, but participated solely by keeping time on his small drum. He has been homeless in the streets of Santa Cruz for about 18 months now and has been taken to court for sleeping out of doors twice. Now this man who sleeps in the dirt has been issued an expensive citation. He doesn't have the income to pay the $70 fee to register for the so-called humanitarian option of community service, much less pay the fine. And if he doesn't take care of it, he will eventually wind up being jailed for it down the road. Ironically, Robert Blind Bear Facer, as I said, who died recently, I guess in Monterey, recently, within the last 6 months, was the cause for which Ed Fry, the activist currently under house arrest for sleep crime, started the Peace Camp 2010 sleeping vigil in front of the courthouse about 6 months after this ticket was issued. I was just making a joyful noise to the Lord, said Facer, on the Feast of Epiphany. Facer is Amish. After the last citation was issued, Robert Norris told Schoenfeld that he also wanted to make a citizen complaint. He wanted to cite the citizen complainant, Sean Riley, for filing a false police report, a misdemeanor. Schoenfeld suddenly did a 180. I didn't think his police report was false, she stated. Robert pressed her, why do you think his report is accurate when you said earlier you didn't witness the excessive noise? I didn't say that, she insisted. You witnessed us singing, and yet you didn't cite any of us, officer. I'm not telling you how to do your job, but if you witnessed a crime, you are somewhat obligated to either issue a warning or a citation, aren't you? I did warn you, she said, but you refused to move. I thought this was about excessive noise. If we played more softly, would we be in violation if we didn't leave? Norris continued. Schoenfeld finally and reluctantly admitted that, yes, that would have been legal. We asked to speak to her sergeant and were told he was too busy and would call later. I couldn't understand why Schoenfeld decided to cite us since we had stopped singing or playing any music and had not refused to stop playing or started to play again. I mean, if a cop warns you to stop doing something and you stop, is it really a warning if they give you a citation anyway? Michelle, who is, and the police officer might respond to this, oh, I didn't give you the citation, Sean O'Reilly did. But what's missing from that narrative is that she contacted, with me present listening, Sean O'Reilly and said, they won't stop playing, you'll have to give them a ticket. So she encouraged, if not initiated, this citation, something we brought up in court, but which Commissioner Baskett ignored. Michelle, who is a friend of Coral's, had heard us starting to sing and came down to listen. She also lives in the same building as the complainant. We were all shocked to see that she was cited. She exclaimed her innocence and said, Robert, tell them. I wasn't singing. Robert told her, they don't care. He was right. They didn't. I'm not that much of a singer, but then this wasn't American Idol either, Becky writes. Since we've been warned about something we didn't do, violate the excessive noise ordinance, and then following the warning we had not continued our activity, why the citation? It was extremely chilling because now we had no idea what constitutes a violation of the law, and Officer Schoenfeld was playing some kind of guessing game with us when we asked for clarity regarding what constitutes a violation of the code. When Schoenfeld moved to cite Robert Norris, he protested, "What, me?" Said Robert, "I spent most of my time here talking to people who were signing petitions. I barely sang at all." "I heard you singing," replied Schoenfeld, who had suddenly decided she could determine whether our singing rose to the level of a code violation or not. Apparently, for Schoenfeld, singing anything at all was sufficient cause for a citation. Although, when she walked by, she didn't say anything at all to us, as we were singing previously, about 10 minutes before. Schoenfeld, in a way, left without taking Norse's cross complaint of making a false police report. Valerie Christie of Huff had not been at our event due to her job, but had planned to play with Coral later that night. However, after the citations, both were too frightened to play. Later, we heard that Schoenfeld intimidated two other musicians to stop playing music from the sidewalk in front of Borders Books, which is now, of course, Forever 21, also with the threat of citation based on citizen complaint for excessive noise. Municipal Code 9.36.020, unreasonably disturbing noise, and then she cites the code section, which I've read before. Again, the key sections are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying, or so harsh, so prolonged, unnatural, or unusual in their use, time, or place to cause physical discomfort, and not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully conducted. That section, as again, prompted the law to be called unconstitutional. But in my case, and the case of the rest of us, I thought it would be the basis for the judge to say, well, there were activity was political protesting. It was necessary for them to sing. There was only one complaint from this guy who wants to sleep during the day, and he didn't even warn them. I mean, that, sorry, this is not, I don't know why you're bringing this case into my court. But, of course, the city attorney decided this was an example of essentially pressing the police to have power to simply tell people to leave with a snap of the fingers. That's really what they want to do. They want to buttress this image of themselves as an organization and a city government that facilitates complaints against people on the streets who are engaging in behaviors that people in the shops and the residents nearby don't like, regardless of whether it's legal or illegal. That's the problem that we are facing repeatedly in Santa Cruz. I mean, of course, I spend a lot of time talking about the sleeping ban and the fact that the massive sweeps through the summer on the levee have destroyed homeless survival gear and driven people into nowhere. They don't know where to go, or from one place to another, harrying them around the city. And that, in its own way, is certainly more serious than this, although this is serious in a different way, because some of those folks make their living by singing on the streets or by panhandling, if necessary, or they want to be able to use the downtown area to be in it during the day like the rest of us. And the police are finding ways, and the merchants and the conservative city residents are finding ways to deny them that basic right. And they're calling it, I don't know, uncivil behavior if they object to these sweeps. If they object, if they raise their voices against this, it's uncivil. And it's a behavior problem. And they're not part of the good homeless anymore. They're part of the unworthy people, the transients, the homeless by choice, that sort of thing. You get these phony divisions that have been used repeatedly historically to criminalize groups of people. So, continuing the story by Becky Johnson, again about an incident around the unreasonably disturbing noise law. Without some objective standard, even listening to a political song can be dangerous. Does this mean that when Officer Schoenfeld gets out her ticket book, and the reason for that is the way the wording of the law is, no person shall make, cause, suffer, or permit to be made any sounds or noises which are unreasonably disturbing, and so forth and so on. This is the law that will be reaffirmed on Tuesday at the 3 o'clock session of the Santa Cruz City Council. Does this mean that every time when Officer Schoenfeld gets out her ticket book, every person in the vicinity better get up and leave because this is one SCPD officer who believes in guilt by association? Well, I would say if you're sitting around, clapping when a street performer is singing, you're permitting and suffering to be made these noises or sounds. You're suffering them, I guess. And the reason that that Becky talks about Schoenfeld's being selective or being the danger of people listening is that she drew in people who weren't present, who weren't doing anything. I mean, who were present but weren't doing anything. Police have been regularly going up to street performers and telling them to stop playing and move along, or they'd get a ticket from a citizen, a form of pressuring which chills free speech, misreads the law, and allows a heckler's veto to any street singer. Huff members met with Mayor Mike Rotkin on January 15th. He suggested the ordinance did not apply to singers on the street unless they were screaming at the top of their lungs over a long period of time, and promised to look into the matter. If he did, I never heard about it. His perennial solution when he was mayor, and this is a former mayor and longtime, five or six time mayor and longtime council member, and still on the board of the ACLU and big supporter of the sleeping ban and so forth. He never got back to any of us really on this issue in terms of supporting the rights of street performers. And C says, leave it to the courts. Which, of course, not only begs the question as a city council member, but it also pretends that the local Santa Cruz courts have some kind of neutrality or fairness about them, which, of course, they don't. Not on these issues and these class issues. They just don't. It's time for another musical break, and it looks like I'm going to be trying to coax Mike Millen to call on another day, or maybe he'll call later today. I don't know. Mike, if you're listening, please do call in. We're waiting for your call, or I am, and don't want to be reading these old stories, simply, which are already written and on the internet for those who want to read them now.
Young man told me he wants to be a politician, and so he'd better stay away from such things as human rights. As it may come back to haunt him when he's working for the people later in life. Unlikely places, level to the ground. At first we're told it didn't happen, and then, well, maybe it did, but it must have been an accident. Or self-defense, or better yet, they just did it themselves. Where does it stop and where is the line drawn? Shouldn't it be easy to tell what's right from wrong? Should have figured it out by now. No time to be naive. Isn't it obvious who's spinning the web and who we can believe? Locked up for a year, one punished for torturing people, and the other because he refused to commit the same crime. He's a true war hero, and he's serving time. And where does it stop, and where is the line drawn? Shouldn't it be easy to tell what's right from wrong? Should have figured it out by now. No time to be naive, but we're responsible for things we choose not to see. a simple man. My life doesn't reach too far. Told you'll get ahead in life if you only work hard. So I put in my time. Gave them everything they asked me for. But then 6 months ago, told I'm losing my time. I gave them my life, and now they're leaving me to die. And for the first time in my life, I'm asking why. Some lives are worth more than others, and that's just the way it is, I guess. But if some lives are worth more than others, tell me why is mine worthless? I don't know what's more wrong. Man, they won't help me now with that. They knew it all along. I gave them my best, and in return, they treat me like I'm already gone. When some lives are worth more than others, and that's just the way it is, I guess. But if some lives are worth more than
And that was Two More by Sarah Marlowe. You're tuned to Free Radio in case you just got onto the knobs here. It's 101.3 FM. And my name is Robert Norris. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And the call-in number here is 427-3772 and 469-3119, both in area code 831. Again, 831-427-3772, 831-469-3119. And Free Radio is, is numerous announcements to bring to your attention. Here's, that one looks a little out of date. We'll put that one aside. Free Radio does have a website, freakradio.org. To catch our stream, however, you have to use a somewhat circuitous process. You got to go to my website or the website for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's actually an organizational website. And it is at huffsantacruz.org. huffsantacruz.org. And you'll find the link for tuning in. It's actually a tune in and a bunch of numbers and symbols. And it'll put you onto the Free Radio stream in case you are out of the area, as Many of our listeners are, actually. There's a lot more folks. I don't know. I've been asked how many are here and how many are there, and I just don't know. But I keep doing this show anyway. It's a mystery to me, actually. So, before I leave the unreasonably disturbing noise issue, and hopefully we'll be able to give you updates on it, who knows? Maybe we could even get an attorney to take a case, if anybody wants to take a case on this issue and challenge the law, which is likely to be passed in a rubber stamp fashion by the city council. I'm going to give you a little description of the city council's upcoming stuff at the next meeting, which is going to be on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. Technically, the meeting, there's an earlier meeting at 1:30. You may remember last week the city council meeting was canceled by Mayor Don Lane because of a Jewish holiday. Nothing against Jews or holidays, but that's not a reason to cancel a city council meeting, particularly the way he did it. He changed it into a special city council meeting, which would deny the public the right to speak on oral communications, which is the time reserved for people who are speaking on matters not on the agenda. Now, it's not that I advise anybody to go to city council these days and say anything to them at all, because I don't think they're listening on the key issues. Of course, it depends if you've got a friend on the city council, or, you know, you're a buddy of Barry Swenson or George Au or Charlie Canfield, you know, some big developer. Hey, you know, belly up to the bar and see what you can get. You may not even have to go to city council. The city council members may carry your water for you. They probably will. But if you're an ordinary person who's concerned with police abuse, a claim against the city, well, the only value of going to city council is some people watch it on the television, on the community TV. It is also archived now online. And if you have enough people with you, it's a way of empowering those people and a way of giving hope to other people in the community. It's not realistically a way of getting change. And that's, I think, the one thing that Occupy Santa Cruz was able to learn. The many people who were associated with Occupy Santa Cruz, I think, was a great education of that. Some still believe in, you know, packing with the powerful and, you know, trying to tease out a smile on their face and believing that somehow they're going to behave reasonably, which I think is a futile and kind of foolish quest. But, you know, there are many roads, and whatever road your experience has led you to believe is the effective one is the one you should take. I think on the issues of rights for poor people, that's until people get power by understanding that they are not alone and that they face common unjust circumstances that are regularly repeated, we're going to be in a situation that's going to continue pretty miserable if you're out there as a homeless folk person or as a renter who's about to be evicted, facing exorbitant rents and absurd demands from the rental company and so forth. On the city council agenda, however, there are a number of items, as I said. The one that I was talking about before is the unreasonably disturbing noise amendment or restatement or the new law that they've cooked up, which really is the old law, which has been sort of sliced off at the arm so that the specific concern of Judge White is addressed. Judge White's concern was that the phrase, which are not necessary in connection with an activity which is otherwise lawfully conducted. In other words, if you do something that a member of the city nearby or a police officer finds unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural and unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person. And nobody claimed that our singing when we did it, or even that Hampsmeyer's singing, the preacher, when he did it, as far as I know, was physically discomforting to anybody. But it then only hinges on, is something unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying? And notice the difference between physical discomfort is different from physically annoying. Sorry, that was the distinction. If it's unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, that's going to be the standard. or if it actually causes physical discomfort, which means, like, you know, it hurts your ears. Unless, of course, you're the city. And unless, of course, you get a permit. And that is going to be their get-out-of-jail-free card for themselves, or get-out-of-court-free, I should say. This time they had to kick down $40,000 legal expenses to the Hampsmire attorney, Mike Millen. So they spent a lot of money defending an unconstitutional ordinance instead of a more reasonable ordinance, such as, I think, the caller who called in earlier proposed. But they're going to come back with the same ordinance again. It's just going to lack the phrase that they put in earlier to protect themselves, because they wanted to protect their garbage trucks and people making a lot of noise, jackhammering for the city. And they also wanted to guard against First Amendment claims against them that, oh, you know, yeah, it's certainly disturbing to hear somebody talking about revolution on the streets, but unreasonably disturbing. Well, that's a phrase. Unreasonably disturbing is not defined in here. It just says unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness. The judge thought that was just fine. Commissioner Baskett had no problem with that phrase. And I was going to read you her verdict, but I'm not. It's long and it's bizarre. It claims that we had a conspiracy going, although no one charged us with that, to disturb people inside the bookshop, because we had anticipated there might be some police action against us, because that has been the case in the past. She said the fact that we made ready to deal with that, because we talked about it before, indicated we had an intention to disturb. Something that even Sean Riley and the city attorney didn't claim. So she cooked up her own ideas, the Commissioner Baskett, who I took subsequently to calling in an unkind way, Commissioner Baskett case. Anyway, you can read all about that on Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking. .blogspot.com. Just Google for Becky Johnson, One Woman, and you'll be all set. And you can catch some of that past stuff. And it's interesting. The details are interesting, too. I think Becky sometimes gets some of the details wrong. Not usually, and not very many. I do, too. I posted Linda LeMaster's court date recently. Linda LeMaster is an individual who's going to court. I've described it before for essentially sleep crime and protest. And it's October 15th. She goes to a jury trial and faces 6 months in jail. And I screwed up her date and a recent posting. So it's not hard to make those mistakes. And it happens. But as long as we correct them and we proceed, hopefully, we will end up where we intended to go, which may not be where we wanted to go anyway, but we end up there. So who wants to end up in court? I don't. But that's often where I find myself, or not often, but certainly with some regularity. And it's part of the game. It's part of what you've got to do in order to maintain basic rights. You have to be prepared to say, no, I won't surrender those rights. Sorry, you know, no offense to you, officer individually, with your gun, your backup, your taser on your hip, your pepper spray. I'm sorry, and I don't mean to provoke you, but fuck off. You know, in other words, you don't have to say fuck off, but you are saying, no, I don't accept that. Sorry. And some people think it's a matter of being nice to the police officer and being civil and all that stuff. And it's not. I mean, it's okay to be civil. I've got no problem with that. But it's equally okay to say, fuck you, because you're angry about what's happening. And a lot of people do. And that's somehow considered to be a justification for police officers beating you up. Well, a middle-class jury may find that to be the case. But I think if you really look at it deeply enough, you see that anger is justified when rights are being taken away. And police officers are actually given their extraordinary powers to protect people and to protect people's rights. Seems to have been a mistake, because that's not what's happening in city after city, at least among a certain class of people. So, the Santa Cruz City Council, as I said before, meets second and fourth Tuesdays of every month, except for August and December. August, there are no meetings. December, there is only one. The holiday again. Although, in this case, it's a little different because First of all, it's expected. There's no surprise. Lane, Mayor Lane, doesn't unilaterally declaring it as he did last week, 2 weeks ago. I'm repeating myself on this one, so I'm going to leave it. But it's just so annoying and so absurd to see the mayor of Santa Cruz saying that he will not hold a public meeting because he wants to move the city council up to campus to chat with the students and because it's a Jewish holiday. And yet at the same time, he doesn't mind holding an earlier meeting of the city council, but one which conveniently excludes oral communication. So there will be oral communication, however, at this current meeting that's coming up on Tuesday. That'll be at 5 o'clock or whenever the mayor wants, but pretty near 5 o'clock, as he vaguely puts it on his agenda. I mean, to be reasonable, of course, he should put it at the beginning of the meeting at 3 o'clock or at the beginning of the evening session at 7 o'clock, where it's traditionally been at the 7 o'clock session. But since the city council, it's taken to cramming everything on its afternoon sessions, and it's taken to eliminating evening sessions often. I suppose they'll say that's a financial saving. They don't mind spending $80,000 on the private security guards. That's on the agenda for city council on Tuesday for the library and the city hall. But they do mind spending the money to pay the staff to have an evening city council meeting, which is supposed to be a public process where people can come, particularly working people, though ironically not homeless people who are in shelter, although there aren't many of those. There's not much shelter. We have a caller, and I wonder who that could be. Let's see. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert. This is Becky Johnson.
The author of Let It Snow, or whatever the heck that story was I read.
Well, I'm certainly not the author of Let It Snow, but...
Fair enough. So, what's cooking, Becky? What have you got for us?
Oh, well, I guess your attorney for the Hampshire case hasn't called in.
Nope, he has not.
I'm kind of disappointed about that. I was very excited to read that article in the Sentinel that the unreasonably disturbing noise has been declared unconstitutional in the Hampshire case.
Mm-hmm.
And that case of a street minister who was preaching a little too loudly and a little too long in front of O'Neill and was cited for unreasonably disturbing noise. And not only did he beat that ticket, but the judge, Ronald White, a federal judge in San Jose, declared the ordinance itself is unconstitutional because it's too vague. And you know, Robert, you and I had that same problem when we were cited on Pacific Avenue for unreasonably disturbing noise, that we didn't know what the standard was for a daytime standard. We're not talking nighttime when most people are sleeping, and the noise standard obviously would be lowered for at nighttime. But in the middle of the afternoon, in the free speech zone, on a public sidewalk, in a very busy downtown corridor, what is the standard for unreasonable noise?
Well, you know, unfortunately, as I said before, the only thing that was found unconstitutional, there were numerous other claims that Hampsmeyer and his attorney Millen made, that the phrases, you know, unreasonably disturbing and so forth, who understands what those mean? You know, and there's no clear standard, you know, in terms of a decibel level. I don't know if Hampsmeyer and his attorney used all those arguments, but those are certainly arguments that have been used about the other aspects. But every other claim, a First Amendment claim around this issue, and I guess White wrote a long opinion, which you can find on the Sentinel website. Actually, the Sentinel printed the entire opinion. Are dismissed. Only this one concern that this phrase, not conducted with, you know, in accord with any lawful act, not necessary in connection with any lawful activity, that was too vague for an ordinary person to understand.
Well, and the absurd way it played out in your trial, where Commissioner Baskett ruled that said that you should only say the lyrics to the national anthem. You can't sing the lyrics to the national anthem because you have the option of saying them instead of singing them.
Well, you know, the problem is not for me to go over Commissioner Baskets and Judge Almquist, who heard your case, is absurd statements, because you're going to get judges who are going to be crazy. Local judges are. They will twist things around in order to, justify police positions, is what I've found is often the case. The real issue is whether, the federal courts, because that's apparently one of the few places where you might get some justice, of course, until it reaches the Supreme Court, and then you're screwed, or likely screwed. But that's the place that people are going to go with this ordinance if they challenge it, if they have any sense and have any legal punch. And that's going to be the problem. The problem is that white, although it won't necessarily go to white, it could go to another district judge, I believe. Although I'm not too clear on the specifics there, but I think it can be, maybe it will be white. I don't know what the story is. But if white can only, the only phrase he can find any problem with is not connected with any activity otherwise lawfully conducted, which to me actually was in a way the saving grace of the city's ordinance. The city's ordinance said, yeah, unreasonably disturbing, blah, blah, blah. But if you're doing something that's conducted in terms of a lawful activity, it can't be found.
Like speaking or singing?
Yeah,
First Amendment
activity, if you're a merchant and you're setting up a display and, you have to shout upstairs to get some information and somebody finds that disturbing, you say, no, it's necessary. The activity I'm conducting is lawful. And so, in a way, it theoretically provided a check. And, of course, we should realize it doesn't provide a check if Commissioner Baskett wants to find it, us guilty. But it's kind of interesting that the judge found that this was the phrase he didn't like. What's coming back at City Council is the entire ordinance minus that phrase, plus a permit provision saying that, or unless you are taking action which you've issued a permit for by the city, and that, of course, is their way of very tightly controlling what goes on at Pacific Avenue, and it's completely in contradiction to what the old traditional Pacific Avenue approach has been. You don't, if everybody who wanted to make speeches or sing on Pacific Avenue tried to get a permit, there'd be far less of that activity, I think, on Pacific Avenue. And there will be if the police take this seriously. Although, again, I don't think they will. I think what they do is they simply use it as a heckler's veto.
I'm familiar with the permit process on Pacific Avenue for free speech activities, and they usually involve some variation of what the existing laws are. For instance, the move-along law, which only allows you to set up for 1 hour in a 24-hour period at any one location. At least that's the way some have interpreted that. And that you can get a permit that allows you to stay there for 2 hours. Or you can get a permit to have a very large group set up, or you're going to have amplified sound for a short period. Different things that are sort of variations on what the existing code is. Are you saying that they want people to get a permit for everything?
Well, I'll read you what the new ordinance says. Here's what the new ordinance says. The new ordinance says, unreasonably disturbing noises. And this is going to be voted on Tuesday and then voted again on 2 weeks after that. No person shall make, suffer, or permit to be made any noises or sounds which are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or which are so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural or unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person.
I guess that's the one we were convicted on.
Well, there was the additional provision of what we were convicted under that said, that the lawful activity was an exception. But that removes
I'm
not finished.
And Almquist didn't even give us time. In my case,
Becky,
didn't even
let me finish the ordinance.
Us time to present that.
Yeah. The rest of the ordinance reads, however, they're amending section 9.6, 36020 for those who are got a code handy. And Section 9.3025 is amended to read as follows. Public health and safety. This chapter, meaning the unreasonably disturbing noise above, shall not apply to refuse collection, recyclable collection, or street sweeping activities undertaken by or pursuant to contract with the City of Santa Cruz. Similarly, this chapter shall not apply to any other activity undertaken by the city, another governmental agency, or city contractor for public health and safety purposes when, in the judgment of the city or governmental agency, such activity cannot be undertaken effectively or efficiently in compliance with the regulations set forth in this chapter. That's Section A. And Section B is, this chapter shall not apply to any event that is conducted in accordance with a permit and all applicable permit conditions issued by the City of Santa Cruz. That's the new ordinance. So, yeah, apparently, and you asked me the question, does that mean everybody has to get a permit? Well, if you want to feel safe from the unreasonably disturbing noise ordinance, you know, and you're doing anything, and the police are in some way critical of you, or the merchants don't like you.
Well, just from a plain reading, it doesn't sound that way. It sounds like, if we were going to set up a political
you have to get
and ask people going by, would you like to
sign a petition,
wouldn't be unreasonably. You wouldn't require a permit for something like that, according to the plain reading of this new ordinance.
It depends on how anyone interprets the words of the ordinance. We didn't think we needed a permit to do what we were doing. And the point again, was that the reason that we did what we did, and we didn't immediately say, oh, okay, we'll leave, you know, or whatever, that's what they want us to go, is that we were trying to show that the police cannot tell people to leave. They have to tell people, they may tell people to play more quietly. And, you know, people may decide to do that. Or, you know, a merchant may come and ask you to play more quietly. And that's the way it used to be. There was a direct interaction between merchants and residents and people on the streets. The best way to go. But no, the only way you're protected from this ordinance is you have to get a permit. So it doesn't mean people are going to go get them. And doesn't mean that the police are going to stop everybody who doesn't have them. But it means that danger is going to be there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was there before and will be unchanged by this. And what we have now is police going up and down and moving along almost every street performer. We had, you know, people that were a Christian group that was singing Christmas carols outside of Borders Books, and they got cited. People who are no amplified sound, doing very traditional activities, the noise that a street performer produces is in no way, say, comparable to, say, a motorcycle revving or a car honking its horn. Those are much louder than, on a decibel basis, than an unamplified street performer, whether they're playing an instrument or just singing a cappella. Some instruments are louder, you know, say like a saxophone or a trumpet. They're potentially louder than a singing voice.
I think the point is that the ordinance is going to continue to allow them, and even more so than before, because now there isn't this, you can't make the claim in court that you were doing this in accord with a lawfully conducted activity. It'll just be the question of whether you had a permit, or whether to an ordinary person it was unreasonably disturbing, you know. And that is such a vague and subjective standard that I would hope that at some level, some judge would say, this is ridiculous. But Judge White didn't say that about those words. The only thing he had a problem with was the fact that it was, this lawful activity. Go ahead, Becky.
Well, you know, I think the ordinance, when I read it, I wasn't concerned that we would be committing unreasonably disturbing noise, because we weren't doing anything that was so prolonged or so sharp or hurt people's ears particularly. I mean, unless someone was just being funny. And,
yeah, I mean, see, we've talked about this a lot on
music
the
critic.
We've talked about this a lot on the show over the last 2.5 years, and
if you don't want to hear anymore, I can always hang up.
Well, it's up to you, but I mean, I would like to talk about what we can do next, you know, which is what can we do in terms of this, the ordinance coming up at City Council. What can we do if and when the ordinance passes? I don't think there's any question. There's a you know, it's interesting. One of the members of Occupy Santa Cruz wanted us to propose an alternate ordinance and maybe get Mike Millen to propose an alternate ordinance, or Ray Glock-Grunike, the legal worker, or Jonathan Gettleman, somebody, that would be a better ordinance, kind of beat the city attorney to the pass. And I know Ray had some thoughts on that, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I would like to look around at other noise ordinances at other cities and see, since we're going to have to redo this one, why not get one that has really clear standards so people understand what is permitted and what is not permitted. And I don't think that just taking out this phrase, which was confusing and open to all kinds of interpretations, the one that they're planning on taking out, I don't think that fixes it, really, because they're still saying that if one person anywhere within earshot of you says that it was physically disturbing or too prolonged, I mean, one person may think that's great, you know, and another person say, hey, you went on too long. You know, maybe they think, you know, with the move-along law, they can just move everyone along after 1 hour. Please.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure they do. You know, and I'm looking here.
By the way, let us name names. Who brought the move-along law? That was Cynthia Matthews and Ed Porter.
Yeah, I know, and Cynthia, of course, is running for Santa Cruz City Council. You know, I'm looking at the San Mateo ordinance here, and I kind of want to bring this to your attention, Becky. This San Mateo ordinance, and that is an interesting ordinance, Becky.
Any place on a sidewalk in downtown Santa Cruz, which is, by the way, the center of our community.
Yeah, let me bring to your attention this San Mateo ordinance, which I've drawn up. It's very interesting. It's called Noise Regulations in the San Mateo City Code. It has definitions of noise level, maximum level. It has definitions of ambient sound and sound level. And it also has designated noise zones. It talks about 5 dBs for a cumulative period of more than 15 minutes in an hour, or 10 dBs for a cumulative period of more than 5 minutes in an hour. It has really, and it has some, it's very specific, you know, that it's, I'm not saying that everybody who wants to sing on the avenue should have to get a decibel meter, but at least gives you some idea. I mean, you could, you know, I think you and I talked about it. Like, we went out there with a decibel meter.
I think there are a lot of smartphones.
Yeah.
You can now get
an app in your smartphone
for a decibel meter.
So I guess an alternate ordinance for City Council might be to propose the San Mateo ordinance. And that, if people are interested, this is coming up on the City Council agenda. And it's going to be item number 18. An item or two after the consent agenda, which usually is swept through like a, you know, shit through a goose at the Santa Cruz City Council, because you can't pull those items off the agenda without permission of the council.
It used to be that every citizen in California really could come into the city council and listen and pull a consent agenda item, meaning you could talk about any item that was on the agenda if you wanted to.
Yep. You know, there are items on the consent agenda that people might be interested in pulling off or talking about. They give you a tiny 2-minute period to talk about all, I don't know, 5 to 30 items on the consent agenda crammed together in one quick speech. But you can also importune a council member and say, please, sir, please, ma'am, can you take this off? Which I think I did, not quite in those words. I said, you know, I want to take this item off. And Catherine Byers said, okay. She may do that this time. There's the actual claims against the city. There are many liability claims for police misconduct, and I think you pointed out, Becky, maybe it was you or not, but there's a whole bunch of people, seven people at least, who are claiming police misconduct. I guess
there are nine of them.
Nine of them. Well, I'm thinking of,
and they're all part of a motorcycle club.
Yeah, I noticed that the headline for today's Sentinel story has to do with the gang task force and how wonderful they are and what a great job they're doing and so forth. And I haven't researched the gang task force, but I'm always mightily suspicious of Sentinel puff pieces on the police, particularly, you know, these super-funded task forces that sort of etch out a very particular villain, whether it's...
All right, well, let's talk about the claims against the city, which are these nine people from out of the area. They were traveling through the city on motorcycles, and they were pulled over, detained, and searched. And they are claiming that the city falsely did an unlawful search on them.
Yeah.
There was no pretext to do that search.
Yeah, that is actually also that is on the agenda of the closed city council session too. So what's going to happen is the closed city council will make a decision on that, and the city attorney, it'll also be on the consent agenda, which in essence will uphold, I suppose, the decision of the closed city council in open session. But if somebody wants to talk about it, you can either go at 1:30 before they make a decision in the closed session and talk briefly in what's called the open interval, and that's in the little area behind the city council chambers. It's a kind of the city council conference room. Or if you want, you can still talk on the item after they've made a decision, and that is going to be at 3:00, and it's item 2 on the city council's consent agenda. But again, this is the consent agenda, and you have to pull it off. And you can't pull it off because, unlike in other cities, we don't have that power since then Mayor Ryan Coonerty removed it, and now Mayor Don Lane has not restored it. So have you got more information about these nine cyclists and what their claims are? Have you done any research on that?
I forget the name of their motorcycle club, but it's supposed to be an offshoot of the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club, which has a chapter in Santa Cruz County.
Uh-huh.
And so this was part of some sort of task force for crime eradication, and they had picked on this particular club as they're going through, but apparently they didn't actually wait till they had any evidence of wrongdoing or evidence of a crime when they pulled these guys over and did a search.
Now, where are you getting,
I think they did find...
Becky, where are you getting all this from?
One or two of them or something, you know. But
Becky, where are you getting all this from? Where's your source? Hello?
I mean,
is this from a Sentinel article? Is this from conversations you've had with other folks?
No. I got an email from Gail.
So this is an email from another.
You probably got the email too.
This is from an Occupy Santa Cruz person. I'm not saying she's unreliable. I'm just wondering where it comes from. So she could well be right, and maybe we should try to get her on the phone to talk. Although I think she's a shy one. I know it says in the claim, it gives the date, February 25th, 2012, is the occurrence, and the date was in August when they actually filed the claim. And it says, seeks damages for unlawful stop, search, and false arrest. And they're represented by legal counsel. So this is a kind of a pushback by this group of people saying, mm-hmm. you know, all these things happen. This happens all the time, of course, to poor people on Pacific Avenue. Unlawful stop, searches, and false arrests. And particularly the tickets that are, you know, they're technically non-custodial arrests, but people don't have the resources to take it to court. They also don't want to offend the police department and everybody else.
Give an example. If a person is sitting on the sidewalk 13 feet from a building instead of 14 feet from a building, a cop can come up and detain them and do a warrant check and all kinds of stuff, whether they cite them or not.
You know, the interesting thing also is, even if they're sitting 14 feet from a building, when the police officer comes up and demands your ID and so forth, 9 out of 10 people, I'm afraid, are going to give it to them. Instead of saying, you know, officer, I prefer not to discuss anything with you at this time. Am I free to go, or am I free to go back to my business? Which is what they need to say. You know, if I'm guilty of some kind of a crime, you know, we can talk, I guess, or you can arrest me and we can deal with that. But what do you, in other words, instead of asking the officer questions about what he's doing, they start answering questions and giving information that they don't have to give.
So anytime a cop says, may I search your bag, or can I look at your stuff, or can I see there, if he asks, you know he doesn't have permission.
Well, also, if a cop starts searching your bag, the appropriate thing is to immediately say, you don't have permission to search my bag. I just want to let you know that. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to.
The magic word is consent,
mm-hmm.
and which has a legal meaning, and you can say, I don't consent to this search. You're searching without my consent.
Yeah, if you say, please don't search my bag, that's also not giving consent.
Yeah.
So in any case, the point is the cops will do this without even any kind of cause often, because they're assuming people will permit it, or they'll say, can I do this? And you, at which point you say, you don't mind if I do this, because you're not guilty of anything, right? And you say,
I'm
not guilty of stupidity, and I'm not guilty of giving up my privacy because you decide you want to look at my bag. No, you know, sorry, officer, I, you know, don't think so.
What more evidence of sitting on a sidewalk is a cop going to find in your backpack?
Yeah, you know, for sure. That's the rational and the reasonable sense of what might justify such a search. I guess they might say, well, because we want to make sure you don't pull out a stiletto and go after me, or, you know, it's obviously it's a fishing expedition, and that's what happens a lot. And also it's self-justification. Police officers need to justify what they do. They are doing things that you and I would not do. You and I would not go up to people we don't know and start searching their bags.
Most people don't want to be a policeman. They don't think that job appeals to them. They don't like, there's a kind of an old phrase that says, if you want people to like you, become a fireman. Because everything police do, it's not well received by the public. I mean, if they're going to arrest someone, the person being arrested does not like being arrested.
Well, you know, I don't really agree with you that it's not well received. I wish you were right. But I think the reality is, though, that what a police officer does is so much different than what you and I do that it really requires a much higher standard for that to be appropriate. And the thing is that when people are afraid of, you know, being ticketed, they're afraid of incurring animus, they're afraid of violence against them by the police, they're afraid of, you know, creating a bad impression by others who are watching, perhaps. These are all things that play into the surrender of basic rights, which I, of course, and I think you too, encourage people not to do.
Well, a lot of people think, oh, it'll sound suspicious if I say, no, I don't want you to search my stuff. I mean, just get over it. Just say no.
So there are these, cases on the city council agenda. People want to go, as I said, the 1:30 closed session, which might be interesting for people, although you'll only be able to talk about those items that are on the closed agenda. Another item on the closed agenda, for those who are interested, on the Tuesday city council meeting, is the case of City of Santa Cruz versus Norris, It's actually Norris versus City of Santa Cruz, because I'm suing them.
Right, suing them
for false arrest,
have been for 10 years.
And that is a case that, you know, you and I, Becky, know about. We've been working on it, trying to get witnesses together for the trial in federal court that's coming up. We have offered to settle the case out of court with the city. And so far they've refused. There's still a chance they may seek to avoid the additional $20,000 to $50,000 that will be spent in this latest trial, which They'll probably
lose, I don't think they
which,
care about
you know,
money.
Which they'll probably lose, but which they will also probably appeal if they lose, spending still more money. So this is sort of an endless drain. And people have said to me, you know, spare the citizenry, you know, surrender to the city council. It's not just a matter of my being stubborn about it. You know, I think city council, the way it conducts its meetings, is just increasingly opaque to people who want to come in, and increasingly potentially repressive. You know, when I don't think Don Lane has had anybody arrested or excluded that I recall, in this year. Have you, Becky? I don't know.
I don't think so. No.
And you know, that's commendable. But the next mayor, the next mayor is going to be Hillary Bryan, and we don't know what's going to happen with that.
Arrested or excluded.
I'm sorry.
I don't like Cynthia at all, but. You know, she didn't do that.
You're saying Cynthia Matthews is running for city council and was former mayor, hasn't excluded anybody.
I've seen her. I mean, she's been mayor twice now, right?
Yes.
And in both years she was mayor, she never arrested anyone or had anyone excluded.
Right, but of course she does attempt to exclude people from eating across the street from her famous historical house at the Red Church, and doesn't mind putting on the record the fact that, you know, that city council supposedly is following this whole thing. So
people, I mean, it's just shameful what she's done. And violates city process by taking her campaign and writing a letter on city letterhead stationery as though she was speaking on behalf of the council. She was not. And she didn't divulge that she owns a home right across the street from the church. She's done shameful things. But it's not necessary to arrest people at
so,
city council.
Again, getting back to the city council agenda, sorry, Becky, I want to really get back to the agenda. You know, that's what I want to do here. So let's get back to the city council agenda, if I can.
Nazi salute.
Becky doesn't really be here. She isn't hearing me. But Becky, are you still there?
What?
I'm trying to.
Was I speaking too long?
No, we're trying to focus on the city council agenda. That's what I'm trying to go through.
Okay. And, you know, I'm starting to get frustrated, so I'm going to hang up.
Okay, well, thanks for calling in. Other items on the agenda are, as I mentioned before, police patrols, I should say private security patrols, which are coming up. That I've talked in the past about there being, in a previous city council meeting, I think the first alarm security contract for $240 or some such $1,000 came up, and that actually prompted some people to come to city council and oppose it. In fact, every speaker, I think, opposed it. But, of course, city council voted it through with nary a dissenting vote. Now we have another item coming up, and also on the consent agenda, which is the first agenda of the day, starts at 3 o'clock, City Hall Security Program. And what that reads is, let's see here, looking at their report, which is a little hard to draw up here, but it is coming up slowly. You can find this online. If you go to City of Santa Cruz, for some reason, it's not coming up as it should be, but I luckily have it's written in another place, so let me quickly find that. This is a resolution amending the fiscal year budget to appropriate $80,000 to pay for additional security guard patrols of the City of Santa Cruz, City Hall campus, City Annex, surrounding city offices, and downtown library. Have you noticed assaults on the library and the city buildings lately? I haven't. I have noticed signs being posted. They were posted 2 years ago to drive away people from the Peace Camp 2010 protest. And I have noticed the removal of shrubbery from around the library. And I'm sure Becky probably would have noticed other things. And if she wants to call back and give us more info on that, that would be great. But what this states is, here's the background of this $80,000 kickdown to, you know, I've called these guys thugs with guns. They don't actually have guns. I think security guards have something else. I don't think they're carrying that. They're carrying some kind of weapon. But no, I don't think it's a gun. As community facilities frequented by visitors, residents, and city workers, it is essential that City Hall and now our downtown library are safe and welcoming venues. Unfortunately, visitor complaints about threatening and illegal behavior taking place in our City Hall campus have increased significantly in the past year and dissuaded in-person visits to City Hall to conduct business. Incidents such as drinking, smoking, fighting, urinating, and illegal camping committed by individuals congregating in and around City Hall had become commonplace occurrences. Of course, there's nothing attached to this that documents any of this. And I've heard of one or two instances of a person who was told he was leaning his bike against a city building, and he essentially told the security guard to, you know, bug off, and if you want, call a cop if you think that's illegal, because it isn't. But I haven't heard of, you know, there being a significant crime wave, a urination wave, a fighting wave, even a smoking wave around these buildings. This is just a way, it seems to me, this is disguised gentrification. This is a place where people have traditionally felt there is some kind of a safety zone. You'll often find homeless people in different cities go to the library, either in the library or outside the library. It's been sort of a safety zone for folks. No longer, thanks to Mayor, our great homeless champion, Don Lane. I don't see any specific justification of this, just like the downtown parking lot panic law, as I call it, or a parking garage paranoia law, as I call the earlier version. They don't present any real evidence that there's there's more crime here than anywhere else, and that there's some sort of particular problem here that's going to require stormtrooper approaches to the situation. You know, having people in uniforms marching around, which does not necessarily make it a welcoming approach. I think this notion that police make you more secure is part of the Bush-Obama-era fantasies that going after killing people in Pakistan is making the world safer. It's all a bunch of horseshit. I mean, it's just not true. It is a self-interested argument that is used to beef up police forces and armies and elect politicians and protect embarrassed bureaucrats and also conceal real poverty and need, which for some people is such an embarrassment that they want its visible presence to be a crime, hence all the downtown ordinances. This agenda item, which again kicks down $80,000 to private security forces, says the staff report says, additionally, city staff expressed concern about feeling unsafe both coming to and leaving the workplace. Incidents of illegal drug use and other illicit activity. You see, it really boils down to sort of the behavior that you and I do in our homes, but it's not legal outside. Smoking, drinking, using the bathroom, and although City Hall bathrooms are open during the day, I'd like to see how many instances of urinating or defecating we have during the day. I'll bet there are very, very, very few. And the notion you're going to start paying somebody $80,000 to make sure that somebody doesn't take a dump behind a bush at some point, when that has happened very infrequently, is a ridiculous waste of money and really must be disguising something else. And I think it is. As a result, however, our city manager's report continues, calls to the Santa Cruz Police Department increased, requiring them to direct their patrols to the city campus area at the expense of other SCBD priorities. All right, so what's needed is, of course, a Public Records Act request to determine just what's going on. But, of course, by the time I get that request granted in 10 days, this will have been passed and it'll all be history. But it's probably worth doing anyway. Increased police presence improved the conditions on the campus and library, but only intermittently. As soon as the police left the area, similar inappropriate behavior, people fell asleep again nearby, typically reemerged. Assigning dedicated police patrols to the area proved an inefficient use of the city's limited police resources, so they're going to spend the city's limited budget by hiring thugs from private security guards to walk around and try to intimidate people from even being there, because I think that's the issue. Although, full disclosure, the only complaints I've heard about the police patrols have been that, quote, they follow us into the bathrooms while we pee. And I've only done some really cursory shadowing of these security guards as they walk around. I did so on two occasions, and they look kind of tired and not terribly happy to do their beat. But I didn't see them harassing anybody, but then I didn't see anybody hanging out either. So, you know, poor and homeless people often have warrants for phony crimes or for petty crimes. And they shouldn't, and the idea that they don't have a right to live, period, without fearing police wherever they go, kind of reminds one of the story of Jean Valjean, the 19th century book Les Miserables, if you're a reader of those sorts of books. Anyway, continuing with this, in order to address the ongoing safety concerns and foster a welcoming environment for city employees, visitors, and patrons, the city manager instituted a pilot program of 7 days a week, 10 hours per day, private security walking patrols of the City Hall campus to supplement the existing nighttime patrols. First alarm security guards now walk the City Hall campus, City Hall annex, downtown library, city attorney office, parks, and recreation offices, morning to evening, in the process contacting individuals who are in violation of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code. You know, sitting too near a building and things like that. Although the library and the City Hall were actually outside the area where the sitting ban applied, but not where the sleeping ban applied, and not apparently where the existing ban applies after 10 o'clock. I think it's 9:30 at the library and 10:30 at the City Hall, something like that. Unilateral postings by Danette Shoemaker, Parks and Rec Department. Private security guards have proven themselves effective in reducing threatening and illegal behavior, not to mention all kinds of legal behavior, since people have been discouraged from being there. Staff and visitors, as well as neighboring residents and business owners, have expressed their appreciation for the effort. Additionally, the security guards serve in a city ambassador role, regularly directing visitors to their desired locations and orienting them to available city services. Such implementation of the pilot program, city and library staff regularly receive positive comments at our many public counters, with visitors complimenting the welcoming, inviting, and comfortable environment at City Hall and the downtown library, and so forth. So they're requesting a budget adjustment for private security walking patrols. Out of enterprise funds, $72,400 from the city's general fund and $3,500 from the library fund. And not to mention $4,100 in city enterprise funds. So this is being submitted by the assistant city manager approved by whose name is Scott Collins. I don't think I've ever talked to Scott. Have to get on the line and chat with him and see what other schemes he's got in mind. And Martine Bernal, the city manager. That's item 12 on the consent agenda. It took me a long time to get through that one. Sorry, folks. Trying to be very brief to summarize the rest of this. Item 13 on the consent agenda is DSAL Task Force amendments, which I am not authorized or actually knowledgeable enough. Nobody authorizes me to do anything, but I don't know enough about this. In fact, what I may do is contact Steve Plaich, who has been doing work on the DSAL, actually the Alternatives to DSAL Committee or Task Force or whatever it is, and perhaps he has some information for us on this subject. If he can be reached, he often is doing suicide prevention or beach cleanups or needle exchange, or more recently, city council canvassing and electioneering. It looks like he may be busy here. If you have a problem and you're a homeless person who has gotten a citation or some kind of harassment, he might be of use to you. You can give him a call at 466-6078. 466-6078. And
your call has looks been like forwarded we're going to reach him automatic voice message
online,
system.
And I'll ask him about this.
Is not available.
And we'll
at
leave him
tone,
a message.
Please record your message. When you
again,
466-6078
to reach Steve Plage. Hey, Steve, this is Robert at Free Radio. I notice item 13 on the City Council agenda is City of Santa Cruz and Soquel Creek Water District DESAL Task Force Amendments. And it's a motion to authorize the city manager to execute a continued amendments, combined amendments to the to a couple of agreements. And I'm wondering if you have any information on that. Give a call, 427-3772. And maybe you'll call in, maybe you're not. And let's see about that. Aha, that could be him calling in now. My goodness. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Well, hey, Robert.
Hey.
I wanted to mention that Eric Hammer is running against Bruce McPherson for 5th District Supervisor.
And the 5th District covers what area, caller?
Well, it's interesting. I have it on the map here. Actually, I found a map on McPherson's website. The eastern boundary is Highway 17, so it includes the city of Scotts Valley and everything up to the summit, up to Santa Clara County. And then it comes down through, it goes all the way over to Bonnie Dunes, so from 17 over to Empire Grade in some areas, includes all of San Lorenzo Valley, and then it goes down into Pasatiempo, and it includes some parts of the city of Santa Cruz. It goes down Ocean Street as far as Broadway. It goes out the freeway as far as Morrissey Boulevard, and it goes over, way over to High Street and Bay.
So it's kind of a mix of Scotts Valley and Santa Cruz, pretty much. Am I missing...
Santa Cruz, Scotts Valley, and San Lorenzo Valley, and the summit area.
Well,
and, but then.
Okay, I know a lot of colleagues of mine are big supporters of Eric Hammer. Those who are involved in electoral politics at all, a lot of us aren't. And
I wanted to mention that he had just recently gotten the endorsement of the Sierra Club.
Uh huh. The same Sierra Club that threw out the old leadership on the Brommer Broadway bike path, as I remember. But yeah, I don't know. So, are you a supporter of Eric? And if you are, why should people vote for him if they're voters?
Well, you know, I actually don't know him that well. He's a contractor in Boulder Creek, and he has support from progressive organizations in Santa Cruz and. But mainly, I just want to, if you go to Eric's website, you can see Bruce McPherson's voting record. And Bruce McPherson, if you want to vote for him, he lives in Pasatiempo, which is a gated community, I guess, with the 1%. And he has been state senator and secretary of state, and formerly also the publisher of the Sentinel and owner of the Sentinel, and a Republican, but just recently changed from a Republican to not Republican in order to get Fred Keeley's endorsement, or that was the story anyway. So if you want a Republican that lives in a gated community, vote for Bruce. He's got a lot of name recognition. He's been around a long time. He's got a record, a voting record that you can look at.
Who else is running other than those two?
There were several candidates, but everyone dropped out because there was what we're having now is a runoff. Because Bruce McPherson got, I think, 38%, but he needed 50% to win, and so now he's in a runoff with Eric, and it's only those two who are running.
And I guess there's a considerable differential in who's spending what amount of money in this campaign. Or any figures?
McPherson.
Do you have any sense of how much?
Well, he has the larger signs.
I'm imagining.
And he's advertising. When I go to Facebook, he pops up. So he's spending money there.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that he has a lot more money to spend.
And there's probably some reports about that. You know, I as I said, I talked to Eric Hammer. He didn't seem too well educated on any of these Occupy issues and too concerned about some more basic issues about rent control and so forth. But I don't know. I mean, I've not, you know, we should probably have him on the air and talk to him, and I probably should talk to him again. You know, I'm not, McPherson is probably worse, you know. But again, you know, this lesser evil approach is one that I'm, you know, really wary of. You've heard me on this show going on about that, you know. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't. That doesn't mean others shouldn't either if they think that's the best thing to do. I mean, my general approach is that one should not be beating the drums for a war criminal Obama. You know, if you have to at some point and you decide in a voting booth you're going to hold your nose and vote for this criminal, do so. Although I would think you would really rebel against that anyway, but don't spend your time, you know, boostering him. That would be my thought. But anyway, yeah. So I guess your point is that McPherson sucks and Eric's probably significantly better. Is that?
I agree with you about Obama, but I think that sometimes with some of these local races, these are people that we see on the street, you know, like, I mean, you might walk down the street and see Eric or Bruce, either one.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Fred Keeley on the street, and he babbled at me for 15 minutes, and I was probably too impressed, because I am talking to Fred Keeley, whoa, you know. But, you really have to keep going back to what are these people really doing, and I can't speak about Eric Hammer, I don't know, you know, as I said, he was nice enough to talk to us, but again, he's running for political office, you know, why wouldn't he? The question is then, what are people going to do after they, you know, either get elected, or even more important, what are they going to do after they get defeated? What's their next move? Are they going to, you know, sit around and wait for the games to play again in 2 years? You know, are they going to organize? And that's the issue for me.
Well, thanks, Robert. I just wanted to try to put out a little information to your listeners in case they're interested.
Sure, and call again at any point.
Thanks.
Yeah. Bye-bye. And that includes you, listeners. You can call in if you've got information, particularly about stuff on the streets, 427-3772. I'm having a real hard time getting through this city council agenda because it seems to be taking forever. Usually I try to give it a 5 or 10 minute swath of time, but I guess, you know, I'd originally, Becky Johnson and I sat down the other day. She's helping with this law case, the what I call the Heil-Krohn City Council repression law case. And thank you, Becky, for all that help and you are doing. She's been helping on this lawsuit for many years. And actually, she took the original video that showed me being arrested for this silent 2-second mock Nazi don't act like fascist salute to the city council as they shut down another speaker by threatening her with arrest, even though she had a perfect right to speak. And then they shut me down with an arrest by demanding I leave, and I didn't go. Anyway, this is coming up. It's coming up on the agenda today, on Tuesday, I'm sorry, at City Council, in the closed session, because I guess there's talk of a settlement, which would save the taxpayers money, end this whole thing, so we could get back to it. We're proposing that there be a change in the decorum rules. That is to say that they can't just say, oh, you're indecorous, get out or we will arrest you. You know, can't do that. The only way they can now, and this is according to the courts, not according to the beneficence of the mayor or the wisdom of the city manager or even the, you know, the vote of the voters. This is the courts that have said the Constitution essentially says, in terms of legislative process, you cannot, and not the courts the most wonderful thing, but they have said you can't kick somebody out unless they're actually disrupting a meeting. They're violating a rule, tough shit. If they're disrupting a meeting, that's the issue. And we want that put into the rules real clearly for people to understand. It's not a very unreasonable response. I mean, earlier I'd asked that the sleeping ban be ended and the police stop harassing homeless people in public spaces and that there be very more specific changes. The consent agenda be allowed to be restored so people can
remove items from the consent agenda like they do in every other, almost every other city in California, without having to, you know, bow and scrape to city council members. I'd ask that there be no eviction of somebody from the city council without a positive vote by a majority of the city council, because it's a serious matter when you're denied access to a city meeting. Particularly if you're a public-spirited citizen, and particularly if you're a critic who's trying to raise issues that the city council doesn't want to hear, but the community needs to hear. I think that has all been pretty much set aside, saying, look, at least make this basic change, which has to do with disrupting the city council. And all you have to do is say, agree that the only basis for eliminating someone from a council meeting is a real disruption. Not a symbolic disruption, not a virtual disruption, not a hissy fit Tim Fitzmaurice deciding that he doesn't like a Nazi salute and therefore I should have to go outside. Or, you know, it has to be something that actually stops the meeting in some way. And it has to be the actual behavior itself of the person has to stop the meeting, not the reaction of the city council, which can stop the meeting anytime they want. If they don't like what somebody's doing, oh, you're standing in the wrong place, we're going to stop the meeting until you move. Oh, you've disrupted the meeting, we had to stop the meeting. No, that's not a basis for stopping and for declaring a person disruptive. And the courts know that, and even the district attorney knows that, because I've never been prosecuted in Santa Cruz for any kind of disrupting of a city council meeting. I mean, the case has never been taken to any jury in Santa Cruz or any judge. And I've never been convicted of anything of that kind. And then they're at a trial for anything of that kind, because this is used as it's like police officers telling people to move along when they have no basis for doing so. Or I'll search your bag when you have no basis for doing so. Because people just agree to it because they're intimidated, or they're ignorant, or they're worried about losing favor with the people in question. Let's take a musical break, and I'll be back. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. Stay tuned. You're also tuned to the stream, which you can get to by going to huffsantacruz.org and clicking on the appropriate link.
I'm a simple man. My life doesn't reach too far. Told you'll get ahead in life if you only work hard. So I put in my time, gave them everything they asked me for. But then 6 months ago, told I'm losing my time. I gave them my life, and now they're leaving me to die. And for the first time in my life, I'm asking why. Some lives are worth more than others, and that's just the way it is, I guess. But if some lives are worth more than others, tell me why. I don't know what's more wrong, that they won't help me now, or that they knew it all along. I gave them my best, and in return they treat me like I'm already gone. When some lives are worth more than others, and that's just the way it is, I guess. But if some lives are worth more than dreams.
It's too early for me to be nearing the end. Always dreaming of the day when my real life would begin. And now I'm left wondering, do I fight or do I give in? When some lives are worth more than others, that's just the way it is, I guess. But if some lives are worth more than others, tell me why.
So that was a little more of Sarah Marlowe, and welcome back. I'm still waiting for all kinds of phone calls from you folks out there, so don't be shy. Ah, boy, I'm tired of the city council meeting discussion, but I've said again, there's actually, I think there are two sessions for the city council coming up on Tuesday, and the ones that interest me, the afternoon session is the one that interests me. There's, as I said, a 1:30 session where you, well... We really kind of talked about it. You can talk about security guards, money for security guards at the city library. You can talk about this. Talk about my lawsuit. If you think that's a waste of city money, you can discuss that issue. You can talk about should the city be stopping people on motorcycles and grilling them and searching them and so forth, or falsely arresting them. I think that's actually what the claims are. If they're true, I don't know. And then finally... there's the issue of, well, there are a couple other issues on the agenda, too, but they're not really ones that I normally focus on. There's, of course, the unreasonably disturbing noise ordinance, which does not have a decibel level matter or level or standard, which really would be a way of providing some kind of objective basis for there being a real concern. Although, as I said, I really encourage both performers and residents, if people have problems, go tell people about them. Say, hey, you know, you're kind of loud there. Can you, you know, maybe I just came from the dentist. Maybe I got a special sensitivity. You know, that was the way that the street performers operated between 1980 and 2002, when they changed the law and passed on this absurd move-along law. Person would just come up and say, you know, can you, here's my concern. And it wasn't a matter of law, it was a matter of simply community understanding. So those are the issues on the agenda. That's the afternoon agenda. There's oral communications at 5. On the evening agenda, there's a neighborhood traffic circulation study in response to a Palo Alto medical facility. God, I hate that group. I think I actually used them when I recently had a hospital problem, but... they seem to be everywhere. I don't know much about them. Well, you should all be happy because September 17th through 23rd was Constitution Week, according to Mayor Don Lane, asking all citizens to join in reaffirming those ideals which the framers of the Constitution, blah, 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 militantly protecting, yak, yak, yak. Of course, we still have the curfews up. We still have massive amounts of money going to police and security guards. We still have the case against the Santa Cruz 11 coming up. There's one coming up on Tuesday for those who are interested. That's the day after tomorrow. At 8:15 in Department 6, Cameron Laurendeau is going to be facing possibly a dismissal. It's possible, might be earlier, but according to the Santa Cruz 11 website, it's 8:15. But that's, by the way, where you should go if you're interested in the Santa Cruz 11. Group of people, fine, outstanding, upright, good guys and gals, like me. I'm one of them. This is the attempt to crush Occupy that we've seen throughout the entire country. Not really successful in crushing the visible Occupy, but not successful in crushing the spirits of Occupy folks, which I will now show, I can't really show it to you, but I will play some interviews from the first anniversary of the Occupy that happened on Friday night. Actually, it also happened on Thursday night. There was a open mic at the Sub Rosa where there were some great performance pieces. There was also a five-hour, five-and-a-half-hour picnic and video showing and chat about and general assembly at the Laurel Park, right across from Loudon Nelson Center. Illegally, I might add, in violation of the city's don't be in the parks after dark law. You know, you're too young to go to the park after dark. And that, of course, was an original attempt to go after homeless people in the parks after dark. And that was from the 80s. But it's still with us. And, of course, it's kind of like this creeping shadow. We curfews all over the city, at the county building, along the levee, at the library, you name it. But the Occupy folks, to their credit, 70 of them, 70 or 80, I would say, at some point, defied this curfew. Or they said they ignored the curfew, would be a better way of putting it. And it was fine. Even the cops across the street ignored the curfew, realizing that they didn't want to give out 70 citations. And also, I don't think they much feel there's a problem with a celebration in the park. But when I talked to Lieutenant Flippo, he was previously a sergeant. That is his name, Dan Flippo. Nice guy, you know. All these cops can be very nice people, and they probably are in their everyday life. I mean, you have to actually maintain a certain veneer of amiability if you're a police officer, because it's part of your job. But I think also as individual people, these guys are, you know, they're okay as human beings. But the problem, of course, becomes the kinds of laws they're enforcing and the practices they're doing and the military structure that they are in changes them and changes what they do and changes the relationship that we in the community have with them. That's the problem. But anyway, Flippo, you know, was we were going on about why are you raiding the camps and why are you going after homeless people? Oh, well, you know, the drug pushers and the bicycle thing. I said, well, that's different than taking away people's place to live. Well, people make their life choices, and they made the choices. Oh, they made the choice to be unemployed and homeless and have those big medical bills. You know, it's kind of an argument that, I don't know. It's hard. You can't really win that kind of an argument, or even it's not a matter of winning the argument. It's a matter of, for me, it's a matter of gaining new information about what a police officer or any individual actually has. That, you know, something new they bring to the table, and you know, but also for me, it is a matter of challenging and essentially denouncing the way the police department is behaving, even if they're nice guys. You know, nice guys who are engaging in Gestapo tactics against a poor group of people cannot be, you can't tolerate that kind of behavior. And insofar as, I mean, I don't have the means to change it, but I certainly have the means to speak out against it, and that's what I was doing. But let's hear what went on in the park the other night, or let's put it this way, what I was kind of at the periphery going from one person to another doing interviews. And these are some of the interviews. I think we're going to begin at the park. We may begin another spot, but let's just see what's happening. Or here, in this case. And that, I think, was me playing with the dials in the studio. That was a little Mickey Mouse activity. I'm going to have to work a little more closely on this, but we are going to hear those interviews, so don't go away. Let's just let's hear a softer voice for a moment.
Safe to go out today. There's a big old building with a dust still blowing where a family had a home just yesterday. Now don't worry, right here, getting fire. We're loud and the other children playing. They're trying to pretend and they're trying to forget they didn't say a woman killed just yesterday. Inside, my tears are falling, but I will keep my eyes dry. And if they care to ask me, all I can say, it's just another day, another day fighting, another day.
heard more, so they just no longer care. Another day of hope and that things will be different from what we've always known. Oh, no more walls and no more screams and no more bullets. No more guns. Inside my tears are falling, but I will keep my eyes dry. And if they care to ask me, all I can say, it's just another day.
Never us.
exactly where we're going. We only may remember the past to see what's gonna happen in the future.
And we're going to seg you out of the soft voice of Sarah Marlowe, because we have a another voice, perhaps not as soft, but still very good for our soft-headed Santa Cruz City Council. On the line with me is Mike Millen, attorney for William Hampsmeyer. Hey there, Mike. You there?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for calling in. I know you you had some family business that delayed you for 2 hours, but we're glad you're here.
Pleasure to be here and talk about a subject near and dear to my heart, namely the United States Constitution.
Okay, well, tell me about that.
Well, the case that we're talking about here, Hampsmeyer versus City of Santa Cruz, is just one in a number of cases I've kind of worked on over the years in trying to bring kind of a little more balance to the First Amendment versus the at times strong hand of the police and city councils who, for some reason, seem to like shoppers in their towns but don't seem to do so well when people are speaking freely on the public sidewalk, even though the U.S. Supreme Court has seemed to say that the streets, city streets and sidewalks have been held since time immemorial as the place for free speech. And so the case of Hampsmeyer versus the City of Santa Cruz is just kind of the latest incarnation of free speech versus the system.
You know, Mike, I've been talking around 10. I did some background for folks, although I spent literally tens or maybe even more hours on this subject when I, Becky Johnson, and Robert Blind Bear Facer were facing the same ordinance for singing downtown with homeless lyrics in front of the bookshop Coonerty, as I call it, or the bookshop Santa Cruz, as it's more commonly known, on Pacific Avenue. And we were ticketed and taken to court and ultimately found guilty, and the appeal failed at the state level. Have you ever found any success appealing on constitutional issues in state courts?
Yes, at times, although it is very difficult. I mean, look, it's always difficult. Both federal and state judges understand that there's always in the back of their mind that if the system falls apart, then the culture, they believe, will descend into mass anarchy. So there's this always little tipping point where if you're not sure, you kind of go with the man. You go with the city. You figure out that, you know, if there's no, you know, dead bodies around, then probably it's, you know, is it really that big of a deal? And that's always the feeling I get. But from time to time, you do find cases where even the judges scratch their heads and say, too far. This is too far.
What,
and Mr. Hampsmeyer's case happened to be one of those.
What percentage of, I know you've told me that the number of civil liberties cases you take, and they're all, you say, on contingency, pro bono, they're not, you're not charging, usually the folks, I imagine, can't afford to pay you, you know, but you, sure. your normal practice is, you know, different kinds of more standard legal, you know, what, personal injury and things of that sort.
I would exactly. Personal injury and business disputes. I mean, you know, it's like so many things in life. You have your trade or vocation where you generally, you know, help your fellow man by doing something that's of value to them, whether you're a plumber or you're helping people injured in car accidents or a dentist or whatever. Then you kind of have a passion. And in my case, my passion happens to correspond with my vocation, which is the United States Constitution. Sometimes, on occasion, I do get paid for the work that I do, but certainly quite often I don't.
What percentage of the cases you take are constitutional cases? A very small percentage, I would imagine, because that doesn't
pay
the bills.
Well, it's the sort of thing where I always have two or three going at any one time.
But what percentage?
I mean, right now I have one street preacher who went in front of the Oakland Coliseum, and it's amazing in the video. He's right next to, it looks like a Marine or some sort of, you know, United States military kind of display. I don't know if they're passing out pamphlets, join the Marines. I couldn't quite put it together from the video. And then my client's there with a big sign that talks about, you know, trust in Jesus and some other things. And, of course, you know, the Marines, they completely leave them alone. But then they come to my client and say, hey, you're blocking. You're blocking. And so they, amazingly, they just haul him off. And you know, there's always one or two cases we have going on. But, you know, for the most part, it's certainly a small fraction of the number of cases I take. But when they come along, we take them.
Have you ever had much success in the state courts with any? And if you have, what case do you remember that was successful on a constitutional issue like that?
Let's see here. I mean, there's been a number. I think there was one a number of years ago in the city of Monterey. They had an ordinance which basically said that anybody at any landowner at any time could ask you to leave for any reason. And so that would, of course, mean that they could even ask you to leave because they don't like the color of your skin. And that seems to be in violation of the Unruh Act, which says if you have a public accommodation, you need to, you know, allow, you can't just randomly discriminate against people. And so anyways, a, believe it or not, Superior Court appellate panel upheld a demurrer, basically saying that the criminal charges my client had should be thrown out. And that was upheld in the local Superior Court appellate department. And I don't recall if that was appealed or not. I can't remember, but even having a local appellate department was pretty amazing. On the other hand, in San Jose, we had some pro-lifers who wanted to carry signs, march around the block a doctor who performs abortions, and so they wanted to carry signs on the sidewalk, not going onto his property or anything else. And San Jose passed the targeted picketing ordinance. And in that one, amazingly, this was really amazing, the local Superior Court judge thought it was unconstitutional, but the Sixth District Court of Appeals said it was not. And so that one didn't work out.
I could
probably go through a number of them over the years, and some have worked out and some haven't. There are some state cases, but it's hard.
You know, that particular case I remember because one of our activists was in San Jose and was arrested by the police for protesting at the city council meeting where that, I don't know if it was that particular abortion restriction ordinance, but it had something to do with, she was not pro-life, but she was pro-constitution. Yeah, I mean, we're all pro-life, but none of us necessarily are anti-choice. But
what we're talking about here is it's just anti-targeted picketing. So if you're mad because say Mr. Jones on 123 Maple is the in charge of Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, and you're just a member of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and you think circuses are just very, very evil blights in our society, if you happen to believe that, then you just want to go pick in front of his house and say, ladies and gentlemen, in this neighborhood, you have a terrible person here who abuses animals.
I hear you. Let me though, again, getting back to this issue, the real issue to me is not even whether you win in court, but what impact this has on the practices of the police department and the authorities regarding people. And it looks like in Santa Cruz, it's not going to have much effect. This city council was prepared on Tuesday, and I think I sent you the ordinance. Did you ever get the proposed new ordinance?
I did. Yes, thank you. I read it thoroughly.
Now, all it says is if you get a permit, you're okay. Otherwise, you're open game for this rather vague and subjective set of criteria about, unreasonably disturbing, physically annoying to a person's ordinary sensitiveness, so harsh, so long, or so prolonged to cause physical discomfort. Is that replicated anywhere else in the state that you've seen? Have you done any research on any of this stuff?
I don't know about the state, but I can tell you, in working on the Hampsmeyer case, one of the things we had to go over was not just the issue that we were successful on, which is what about, unnecessary noises, and that's just in the eye of the beholder, the judge kicked that out. But also the more delicate issue, which as you point out, will be the new law in Santa Cruz, that it's simply a one-question test. Is this an unreasonable, basically an unreasonable noise? And I found a tremendous, there are many cases that strike down unreasonably loud noise ordinances. But there are also cases that have upheld ordinances that prohibit unreasonably loud noises. It is a mixed bag. And the judge cites one in Hampsmeyer where they basically said that, there's no inherent right to, give a loud, loud message, a stentorian voice, a word that doesn't get used much, but a stentorian voice on the corner of an area that may have some sort of, you know, especially if it has some mixed residential use, but even if it doesn't have any residential use upstairs, as Santa Cruz does in various places, just said, look, you know, there are shop owners who are captive. I mean, it's one thing to say that if shoppers don't like it, they can move on. But it's another thing some of these courts have said, and look, you know, what's the shop owner supposed to do? He can't move his shop to get away from this. How about a restaurant? So it really is a clash of people wanting to enjoy, in their view, I'm going to call it a pollution-free, audible environment. You know, they consider songs, they consider preaching pollution. I mean, I may not, you may not, but some people do. They're just out for a dinner, and they just like to hear the birds chirping and maybe a few cars passing by, but not a consistent, persistent barrage of noise or barrage of speaking or singing. That versus the right to free speech. And there is a tension there because, I mean, you have to be sympathetic that a city can say there is an audible aspect. To me, what's hard for me about this is that there are such better ways to do it by simply, you know, putting in objective criteria. Like
We examined the San Mateo ordinance earlier. With a caller called in, suggested, and I looked at the ordinance. It's very specific about decibel levels at certain times and certain places. The thing that I mentioned before on the air that has been concerned to me, because I'm a concerned with homeless advocacy and the advocacy is for street performers and political activists who are getting the shaft, is that this ordinance doesn't have anything to do with really people who have legitimate concerns about noise problems. It has to do with someone who, for one reason or another, just doesn't want a person playing, you know, at that particular place. I mean, it may be they think it's too noisy, maybe they don't like the lyrics, or maybe they think they're unsightly in front of their store, whatever it is. The issue becomes when the police officer comes up, and this is what's been happening in Santa Cruz, and I think probably happened to Mr. Hampsmeyer, you know, they say, move along or else we won't give you a complaint because we don't give complaints. We're the police. We're neutral. But we will forward a citizen's arrest, and that will be the complaint against you, and it'll go to court. And in our case, the city attorney defended the citizen's arrest, or actually prosecuted it on behalf of the citizen. So it's bullshit to say that they don't actually, you know, aren't actually an active party in this. They're trying to maintain a pseudo-neutral status. So the question for us has always been, sure, we'll try to keep a little quieter, but we're not going to use this as a getaway, as a you-have-to-leave-here order. And that's what the police are doing in Santa Cruz. Do you have any suggestions for people faced with this new ordinance who are told by police, you know, move along or we'll give you a citation?
So let me see if I understand, because let me give a quick bit of background that may not be clear. About 10 years ago, I had a street preacher who was threatened with citation. In fact, he was cited, and we went to the traffic court trial there in the basement of City Hall, where they do these, where justice is met out to the sheep.
You're such
sheep.
A kidder there, man.
And we beat that. And I wrote a letter to City Attorney Barisone, and said, you know, I think the way you're using this ordinance isn't right. And so I never got a much of a buy your leave back or anything else. And so then a few years passed, and in 2008, a woman approached me who was out singing. I think she was committing the vicious crime of singing a Christmas carol, or she was singing maybe it was a Christian song on the public sidewalk, and they gave her a citation. So again, we went to the great bowels of justice in the bowels of the building over there at the city hall or county, and there we again beat back this application of the ordinance in this particular case. And so that was certainly we were happy about that. And then at that point, I started looking in my file, and I think I came across one other person for sure that had had this problem, and I'm thinking they've been doing this for 10 years where it's, as you say, it's threatened with a citation or give a citation, win in court is what normally happens, and then they've taken care of the problem for the moment. You know, in the 1950s, people did not have a lot of sensibilities about this. So if Harry was drunk It was no problem to push Harry into the back of a squad car, drive him to the edge of town, kick him out of the car and say, Harry, don't come back. And there was a time when the sensibilities of Americans didn't really worry about that. But we're at a point now where people are much more sensitive to the fact that, you know, the overreaching of authority. And so because of that, this idea that we're going to kind of use it as a move along, as a get along, is very troubling. So to answer your question, what suggestions do I have? The first thing is document, document, document. This officer in this circumstance at this time of day, I mean, really, please, if you could just have 3 minutes of video of the surrounding scene, because I got to tell you, if we don't have video, and I'm speaking certainly of my my clients who are pro-life, which happens to be a very unpopular point of view. I'm sure that people for the ethical treatment of animals have a very similar situation. Without video, the assumption is you are a raging lunatic and that there are knife-wielding members of the populace who want to kill you, and they were simply keeping the peace. And this is the way it always plays out, even in the Hampsmeyer case. They talked about how, you know, I don't know, it could be a clear and present danger. You know what? There's some girl drinking a soda saying, I disagree. And that becomes a clear and present danger in the mind of our some of our Santa Cruz faithful, how they blow it up in the police report. So the first thing, though, number one, document, document, document. Number two, after you're done documenting everything, you know, pass it on to myself or another attorney so we can do some sort of statistical analysis. Because the courts are going to say, well, since no one's getting convicted, what do we care? And the answer is, it's being used as a get-along. And so this is not right. And so we've got to have a statistical analysis, but you know, it would just take a lot of effort by a lot of people.
So, yeah, I don't have a lot of faith in attorneys, because most attorneys are not what you are. That is to say, they don't spend a lot of time on civil liberties. Well, they don't spend even... they spend a small amount of time on civil liberties issues, and usually people have to defend themselves. And often when you walk into court with, you know, when your client walks into court with you, Commissioner Kim Baskett, who's probably the person you went before in Department 10 in the basement of the county building, you know, she will take you much more seriously than she will an individual who's defending herself in the county building in the basement. Even with documentation, we had documentation. I had a complete audio of everything. And we had some, I don't think we had video, but we had audio. And, you know, it was the noise that we had in our case came from arguing about what the issue was, because the police officer would not tell us how quietly we had to be. We kept saying, well, you know, what's the standard? I mean, let me sing for you, and is this too loud, or the quiet? She refused to tell us. And then eventually she just, because she didn't like our argument, she advised the complainant, who was trying to sleep during the day above us, to file charges against all of us because we would not leave. And we didn't even say we wouldn't do that, but we said we really wanted to do is find out what the volume was we should be playing at. So what I'm looking for is some, here's very good advice that you're proposing, you know, document it and then get some analysis of all these different cases so you can show it to a court and then get in touch with an attorney who, you know, be interested in doing something like that. We want to do the same thing around the sleeping ban. We have a ban against sleeping in shelter for less than 5% of the people after 11 o'clock at night. It's illegal to sleep outdoors or in any vehicle on any public property in Santa Cruz, which, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people do because they have no choice.
Well, as one judge said, you know, the law prevents both the rich and the poor from sleeping under the bridges, you know.
But, yeah, that was Zola who wrote that in one of his books.
I've always loved that tongue-in-cheek quote.
The law in its awful majesty forbids both rich and poor from sleeping under a bridge or begging on the streets and so forth. Yeah, I mean, that's right. And it's Anatole France, actually, I think. It wasn't Zola. But, you know, the question is, what do we do in the moment it happens? What do we do to dissuade the police from doing this while waiting for the beneficent attorney to show up or the beneficent statistician to put this together? That's what we have to find out, because people are facing this every day and every night if you're a sleeper and you have that kind of problem. So I think, first of all, people gain courage from hearing that not everybody believes that, you know, this this kind of mythology that it's okay for the merchants and the hecklers, essentially, because that's what people are shutting other people down, whether they're preachers or whoever they are, you know, to rule the streets. That there is obviously, the Constitution is there for a real reason, which is that the community gains vibrancy and life through this kind of debate and discussion, and moreover, people have to be protected from the people who happen to have assumed power at one time or another. But what were the details of your victory in court? Do you remember those two cases? I'm kind of curious, when you were in Kim Baskett's court and she found these two people not guilty.
Well, let's see. I know one of them, maybe there's actually three of them. I know the most recent one, as I recall, the complaining witness simply did not show up. That was one, because actually I think there were at least three of them now I'm remembering. Another one, I can't fully remember, but, you know, as we're sitting here talking, I'm not sure if any of these were contested or not. Now that we're pushing the point, I just remember going time after time for at least three or four times, because sometimes they would continue it. At least once, I think they did. But, you know, I don't remember ever having a full-fledged witness trial, now that you mention it. And that was actually something that was troubling to me, which is somebody will say, I'll do a citizen's arrest, and then we'll go ahead and, you know, then they go and they have a trial and they don't show up. So actually, you know what, I'm going to make it clear that I think these were all uncontested. They never seemed to show up. In any of these three cases, if I recall correctly.
And that happens in about half the cases of all these petty infractions. Cops don't show up, you know, particularly if they feel it's going to be, you know, something that they're going to have to fight about. Although, if it's against activists who don't have a lot of legal resources, like myself and others, we do find ourselves suddenly facing the full might of the city attorney's office, and it goes on and on and on, and we get crushed. But we continue to do what we think we need to do and to do the right thing. But the avenue you took was, and I think that's the proper avenue, is to take an injunction, try to get injunctive relief, right, or sue for false arrest. Because the one thing that is dangerous if the police don't show up for the city is they then face the prospect of just that kind of lawsuit. Whereas if they show up and win, it becomes harder. You have to win the criminal case first, right?
Yes, you do need to win the criminal case. But again, I really cannot overemphasize for you the importance of video. A lot of the work I do, as I say, it's, you know, certainly for the most part, it's with an unpopular group that would, you know, be those who are on a, you know, pro-life, anti-abortion kind of message. And I am not kidding when I say that without the video, the judges will believe the adjective-laden police reports that talk about, you know, the crowd is hostile and all these things. And, for instance, in this particular case, you can even read it in the Hampsmeyer opinion. The officers are saying, the officer is saying there may be at least one, maybe two, about how the voice, Mr. Hampsmeyer raised his voice once he was contacted by the police, you know, as if just to kind of make his point and do a one-upsmanship. Well, Judge White looks at this and says, what are you talking about? It didn't seem any louder to me. And that's just actually an example that happened to be, you know, kind of verified by a judge that the police are overreaching. But without video, this is a very difficult exercise. Having a tape recorder does not put it together. What I mean is that when you have video, you can see the frequency and source of all of the factors contributing to the noise. When you have audio alone, there'll be something, but you don't know, you know, what's going on, and it's very hard to put it together. So the groups that I work with, I mean, I'm fairly clear with them. Video isn't just a good idea. I won't represent you if you don't have video, for the most part. There's always exceptions. If you have five witnesses to a fact that's, you know, fairly straightforward, that's one thing. But when we get into, was the crowd hostile? Was the noise obnoxious? Were they blocking the sidewalk? If you don't have video, the system is stacked against you. So I just, I have to tell you, you've got to have a video, which means you have to learn to take video. And there are a lot of people who think that because they know how to push record on their device, that they know how to take video. They don't know some of the really basic concepts of how to take a good video. Can I give you a couple of them?
Oh, yeah, please do. And, of course, this is much easier than it was a decade ago because of all the cell phones. And,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Number one, you need regular, moderately slow pans of the area. So I don't care what's going on. You stop and you do a slow 360-degree turn. I cannot tell you how often the police say, just outside of the cameraman's, right behind the cameraman, was a man who was so angry that he was going to start a fight. And so, of course, we have to do arrests when you're starting fights. I mean, this happens all the time. And when you do a pan, it completely dissolves this ridiculous argument because the police see that the judge says there's nobody there. I mean, this is ridiculous. So that's number one, is do a slow pan. Number two is you've got to be recording, of course, the audio conversation with the officers, because they will say, you know, person refused, this and that. And actually, the person just said, well, I'll move somewhere else, but will you arrest me there too? And somehow it may not come out in the police report that that's what they said. The third thing is record everything. Don't just record the part that you think is good. You need to record. If you're out there for 2 hours, then record all 2 hours, because it's just the way it works. When you turn that thing off, it's when the argument started. I had one case where the argument, where the battery went out for a minute, and this is where the police said all this bad stuff happened. Now, ultimately, the fellow had on an audio device, and we were able to kind of convince the district attorney that, it's true, the camera went out for a couple minutes, but the audio is pretty helpful. And so I actually have standing instructions to people I work with, you know, street preachers especially, buy a $20, little tape recorder deal. No, they're not tape recorders, they're audio recorders now. Hang it around your neck. Keep it fully visible with the red light on, so we're not going to have any argument about secretly recording. I mean, everybody knows what this little thing is around the neck with the red light on. I'm not worried about a criminal charge of, falsely recording private conversations. And that audio recorder can really do the trick, because it gives you audio, whereas the cameraman may be told, please back up 5 feet. And when a police officer tells you to back up 5 feet, you better back up 5 feet. But on a busy street, we may never hear the critical audio that's going on. Did the police officer say there's been a complaint against you by a gentleman over here, or is it just people are complaining they don't like it? There can be a difference. And the next point is someone has to be a dedicated cameraman. It's fine to put an audio around the neck of a speaker. I can live with that. That's fine. But you've got to have someone dedicated. If you're taking turns speaking, okay. When it's my turn to speak, you go up with your camera, you watch with your camera when I go up to speak, and vice versa. But somebody has to be doing it and doing their frequent pans to show what the environment is like. And the really tempting thing is that when the police officer is talking, people are tempted to keep it totally on the police officer. And that may be good, but please do a pan, because the police officer is going to say, that's where I saw the bad guy. Right when I was talking to him, I saw a knife-wielding maniac. So those are some video tips I'd give you.
That's good. Have you written those down for dissemination there?
I probably should. That's a good thing to put in the to-do list. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We're talking with Mike Millen, his attorney for, is it Los Gatos? Is that where you live? Or?
Yes, I'm in Los Gatos.
And you have a brother as an attorney in the same or general area, right?
My brother Mark is a personal injury attorney, and so I kind of tend to put my time into this and do personal injury. He's mostly focused on personal injury and does a great job at it, but we enjoy consulting.
He doesn't scoff at you and say, why are you taking all these lowlifes and fanatics?
No, not at all. I think he's glad that I've been able to kind of work a practice to where I can devote some time to it. You know, it's kind of hard after you've been practicing for a while to kind of jump in. And so, you know, when I get the chance, I love to mentor other attorneys. It's just, it's hard to find people because, you know, people have mortgages and they got, you know, school bills and co-pays and a bunch of other things. And so I happened to get into this when I was just a pup, you know, just fresh-faced out of law school. And the sad point is most attorneys don't understand that this is the best free trial experience you will ever get is to do free speech cases. Because the activists are tickled pink to have somebody with a law degree. They, you know, they're not a huge amount of work. You're getting into a judge. Whereas if you go work for a big law firm, you will be carrying, you know, Mrs. Big or Mr. Big's bags for years before you ever get to say a word to a judge. And even then it'll just be a status conference where you just say nothing's changed. And, you know, that's your big, and even that's a big deal. I talked to the judge today. So that's certainly an encouragement that anyone with sensibilities for this, do this early, because if you don't do it early, you're not going to do it, you know, once you have a practice that's rolling along. You're just not going to go there.
How long have you been doing this law stuff?
Well, let's see. I graduated in 1990, and I taught at Santa Clara University for 1 year as kind of a legal research and writing fellow to the night law students. And then I left there. I thought I'd go work for the DA's office back when I thought that the DA's office was, you know, just the white hat, never could do anything wrong, you know, just very, you know, basically it's an unvarnished view of the way it's supposed, they tell you it works in law school. You know, the DA's office follows the Constitution and follows the law, and this is this. And then you get out, you find out that there's a whole lot of gray. There's a whole lot of gray. There's charging decisions and questions of overcharging. There's questions of, you know, whether, you know, I've seen in all kinds of cases where, like domestic violence is one where I learned about the gray that happens where this must arrest law. I've seen cases where sometimes a woman will strike a man, the police come, or the police tell the man, someone's going to go to jail today, sir. You're going to tell me if it's you or your wife. And other things that are just, you know, absolutely unconscionable, although I appreciate that we have, you know, criminals that are locked away, and there's a lot of good the DA's office does, and I'm glad they do what they do. But like all of us, you know, they make decisions, and sometimes they don't accord with the way I might do things. But in any case, I decided that, you know, the DA's office, I would love to work there, but it didn't work out because there was these terrible budget cuts in 1991. And I was sad because I did want to work for them. I thought they were a good organization. The next thing you knew is I put out a shingle. And one of the first clients that came to me was a guy being sued by his doctor because he was carrying a sign on the sidewalk that said his doctor was a bad doctor. And that's how I got my introduction to free speech.
Did you win?
We kind of wound up at a truce because it was a very complicated question of constitutional law when a layperson says, my highly trained specialist doctor is, you know, made a mistake. It's a very fine question of law as to whether the mistake was one which the layperson is suggesting he has inside knowledge of. Like, you know, he operated on the wrong arm, where a layperson can certainly testify to that. Or is it like the doctor's judgment and, you know, using a, you know, a 6-inch yada yada instead of a 12-inch stent, you know, was wrong. And so it was very complicated. In the end, my client, they just kind of made peace, and that was that. But it was a wonderful introduction to free speech law, and then from there I just started doing work with the Christian Legal Society and other things.
You know, it's interesting because I think I would regard that as a simple matter of free speech. Even if you're not an expert, you can have the opinion. That's going to be my view. And the idea that you can't carry a sign with that view is, unless it is, I guess what the word would be, I guess the doctor isn't really a public figure, so he doesn't have as high a standard you have to prove. You don't have to prove actual malice or, you know, reckless disregard of the truth. But anyway, you know, you took this, even though the charges against William Hempsmeyer were dropped, you sought an injunction, correct?
Yes, we sought an injunction. I mean, normally these cases are for the injunctions. They're not, you know, these are not big money cases where the clients are trying to get oodles of money because, you know, they doesn't work like that.
Let me remind our listeners that this is, we are talking to Mike Millen, who's an attorney, and we're talking about the unreasonably disturbing noise law, which was ruled unconstitutional by Judge Ronald White a couple weeks ago, and now the Santa Cruz City Council is going back, carrying John Barisoni's latest brainchild, or whatever it is, which is the the new unreasonably disturbing noise law, which essentially is I think it's even worse than the old unreasonably disturbing noise law. Maybe I want to ask you about that too. But you had to seek injunctive relief. You didn't wait through a criminal process because there was a criminal process. They did this. We got rid of him. Now we won't bother to take him to court. You know, we can act like he was guilty and we've intimidated him. He won't come back. Has William come back to Santa Cruz? Has he done any preaching since? Has he been intimidated away? Did he do any preaching after the 2010 incident where he was arrested, right? Was he arrested or just cited?
Well, he does lots of preaching. I actually don't remember if he went back or not. I have so many street preacher clients that go to so many different cities, usually with no trouble at all. One of the things I want to say is that while the police are often, you know, I certainly get called in when the police do questionable things, amazingly, the district attorney's office in almost every county, I mean, in Alameda County that I've been dealing with, in Santa Clara County, in Santa Cruz County, the district attorney's office is great. I mean, they take a look at these things and they say, you've got to be kidding. I mean, it's really funny, but the DA just does an excellent, excellent job of saying, we are not spending taxpayer dollars on this.
I got to disagree with you there. Well, the problem, I think, is district attorney, too. But, you know, it isn't the district attorney that handles these cases. It's the city attorney. It's Barisoni's office because he doesn't prosecute them.
In this particular case, Mr. Hampstmeyer was given a citizen's arrest, and then he was given a full-fledged, full treatment by the police. And they sent the entire package over to the DA because there was an arrest under the state law, 415.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're talking about the unreasonably disturbing noise ordinance. Yeah, I mean, then they dropped that charge because they thought it was bullshit, right?
So I guess the point I'm saying is that when I'm just talking about in general, when DA's offices meet free speech, I find them to be on the right side.
Right.
Almost all the time.
Well, I'm apparently under indictment but we won't get into my problems.
Okay, I haven't seen yours. I'm just telling you, in my experience.
No, I understand. There are 11 of us who are charged with felony conspiracy to occupy a building and to vandalize. It's completely bogus, and we've been dragged through the coals for months. But you know, that's part of the attack on the Occupy movement, which is a political attack, which is really, you know, bad news. And district attorneys, unfortunately, are carrying it forward. It takes courts like the Chicago court to say, no, 92 Occupy protesters who were arrested were improperly arrested. You can't set up a curfew at night around a public building that way, something Santa Cruz still has not learned. And it's doing that here anyway. But for me, and again, for this Tuesday vote by the city council, which will be followed by a vote in 2 weeks, which will be followed a month later when the law goes into effect, we have an unreasonably disturbing noise law, which is an ordinance, so it isn't going to go to the district attorney unless, as in the case of, you know, your client, they also try to, you know, jack up additional state charges, which are misdemeanors. This is not a misdemeanor, but it can have the same chilling impact, and I think you didn't take the 415 to try to get injunctive relief as applied or anything. You tried to get injunctive relief around this ordinance, and you were successful. Under what circumstances do you think would you take injunctive relief against this new ordinance, or would you?
Well, I have actually been thinking about that, and a couple of thoughts come to mind. The first thing is that while I certainly appreciate Judge White's analysis on the vagueness of the unnecessary part, I do, with all respect, I don't think the judge was correct when he said that from a free exercise perspective, that the fact that the city gives a complete exemption for any government agency, which for any reason thinks any activity will be inefficient if they have to follow the law. I mean, it's not just garbage trucks can make noise. I could probably live with that. It doesn't say garbage trucks can make noise. It says any government agency of any type, which would in any way be inefficient, does not have to follow the noise ordinance. Now, my point is, these government agencies get a free pass. then they need to give a free pass to people that have the religious belief is that they must be doing what they're doing. And so if I ever met, it would not work for someone who's simply singing political songs. But if we're talking about, you know, free exercise of religion, which, you know, has its definitions and everything else, that I would be willing to take to the Ninth Circuit, because I'm sure the judge will rule the same way, because the ordinance is still has the same exceptions. But I think the Ninth Circuit would be sensitive to that.
And of course,
on the other hand,
for those
if the argument was unreasonable is vague, the problem is there's cases on both sides of it. So I don't know. I guess I'd have to see the case.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible. Remember, you can bring a law can be constitutional on its face,
but not as applied.
But there can be certain instances where it doesn't work.
For sure. Now, I mean, I sense you mentioned you were with the Christian Legal Defense Group for a while, and I guess you still are. Or?
Well, I mean, I'm an independent attorney, so there is more than one group that might call me in and say, you know, we have somebody who needs help. Would you work on this? I mean, I do a lot of work with Life Legal Defense Foundation. We got a big win against the city of Oakland trying to stop free speech in Hoy versus Oakland, which this Ninth Circuit decision that came out last year.
And that was,
so,
again, the issue
not
there was...
I'm a Life Legal Defense Foundation attorney. I'm what they call an affiliate, an attorney who volunteers to help out. If there's attorney's fees that are paid, great. If not, well, thanks for your help.
Do you ever affiliate with lefty groups like National Lawyers Guild or ACLU?
I've never been called to, but on this free speech stuff, I mean, I would not be troubled at all by defending, you know, other groups that want to go out and speak in public. I mean, as a general principle, the message to me is somewhat secondary to the principle.
So what I'm picking up here is, 'cause it sounds like you've done a lot of work with, you know, folks who are trying to express religious ideas and beliefs. I guess I'm going to have to get some religion before I can really pull you on board here. I could start a new religion, constitutionalism. I don't know what I'm going to call it. But I guess you're saying that the law as written, you don't think it's unconstitutional on its face, or there would be some difficulty showing that because there are cases pro and con around the question of unreasonably disturbing. Because it seems to me the phrase unreasonably disturbing is pretty vague, but I guess you're saying that it does have some content sufficient for the ordinary person to know what it means?
Yes. I mean, here's the problem. If you think about the law of negligence, the whole law of negligence is, you know, whether or not there was a duty and was the duty breached. Did you behave as a reasonable person? I mean, the idea of acting reasonable is in other parts of the law. And so reasonability, is somewhat of an objective standard. The idea is that if you get a bunch of people together, there will be a, you know, very clear and distinct sense that something is or is not reasonable. So, I mean, just to make an example, if we know that our neighbor just had quadruplets, and at 2 a.m, we absolutely blast our stereo, and we should reasonably know that this is going to be disturbing to somebody in our neighborhood. I mean, we should just know that, you know. So the idea that we can never know what's reasonable or unreasonable, some of the courts have said, you know, that's pushing it too far. There is a sense of reasonability. But some courts have said that's awfully vague when it comes to the unamplified human voice.
Well, what about this?
There's one decision, I think it was the Costello decision the judge cited, and I may have it mixed up with another one, but it might have been that one where the dissent basically says, I think that was a 2-1, says, you know, it's one thing to talk about amplified noises and reasonability, and that's, you know, that's all great. There's this great Supreme Court case about Kovacs and et cetera. But when we're talking about the unamplified human voice, you will struggle to find a case that says the unamplified human voice, you know, can easily be regulated by, you know, rules like reasonability.
I want to make sure.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure, by the way, you send me a copy of, if you have it, of that letter, any correspondence you have with Barisoni on past such cases, because I think that would be interesting for us to know and to be able to review, those of us who are concerned with this issue. Again, it is the new law, which is coming up at City Council at 3 o'clock, for those who want to on Tuesday to check it out, says no person shall make, suffer, or permit to be made any noises or sounds which are unreasonably disturbing or physically annoying to people of ordinary sensitiveness, or which are so harsh or so prolonged or unnatural or unusual in their use, time, or place as to cause physical discomfort to any person. So there really sound like there are three different prongs you can get porked by. One of them is, as you said, unreasonably disturbing. The other is physically annoying. And the third is physical discomfort. Those are the three standards, it sounds like, that they're having.
Yeah, I never quite knew how to... The first two sound awfully similar to me. I mean, the last one really seems to almost talk about, kind of anatomical processes, It sounds physiological.
Yeah, it sounds like it's, pain in the ear or something,
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the first two, unreasonably disturbing versus the... the annoying. I don't know. It seemed to me to be the same thing.
It does say physically annoying. That's we trouble. I sent you some of the analysis of legal worker Ray Glock Grunike, which you kind of probably looked over in his analysis of the decision. Did you got that, or did it ever give you?
Yes, I did. It was a very well thought out piece.
And I talk about it on the air, but it's really pretty technical, and you have to be interested in those concepts particularly. But I think what people who are listening to this show, some of whom are homeless and don't know where to sleep tonight, others of whom are street performers and don't know how loud they can play, some of them can't afford to have video with them, can't afford any of this stuff. They are, looking for ways to address this issue. Of course, for the next 6 weeks, they're sort of in the clear because there's no unreasonably disturbing noise law until it actually...
That's true.
But I still think if you feel so moved, I'd love to have you write a letter to the city council and send them an email that expresses your concerns about the ordinance as it's proposed, if you have any. If you think it's something that might, lead to more legal problems, that might put us... some of us who are trying to fight this in a better position. I mean, I think, that your suggestion that a decibel law is much, much preferable. I'm sure they'll ignore you, but to put it on the record is still, I think, a great idea. And if you find you're so interested in doing that, CC me a copy.
Yeah, I will think about it. I will say the tricky thing is that this is a very... There's just many, many cities that have passed this kind of ordinance, and so at this point, city council is on much. I think they're on safer ground than they were before. The problem before was that you could never figure out if you were violating the law, because you could make what was objectively that everybody in the room would agree was an unreasonable noise, and yet you could say, hey. It's necessary.
It's necessary in connection with an activity that's otherwise lawfully conducted, yeah.
Right. And so it really made it confusing that, it's okay to make a unreasonably loud noise in certain circumstances if it's necessary. And that was just a real head scratcher. And so now that at least we know we're supposed to know if we're violating the law, because the idea is that we should reasonably know whether 12 jurors are going to find and say, that's just unreasonable.
Unfortunately, we don't get 12 jurors. You'll get one judge. You'll get Basket, who will take. Who will just say whatever the police department suggests is the situation.
Well, you're raising an interesting point, and there's another way to go on this. If somebody was so inclined, they could refuse to have their case tried in an infraction.
You can try that. They will not do that here. And have you been successful with that? Because if it's an infraction, it's an infraction. They can't charge.
I believe I'll have to double check.
Double
I
check
thought
on
there
that,
was
yeah.
a provision in the first couple dozen penal code sections that indicated that an infraction can only be tried as an infraction if you agree, because you give up your right to a jury trial and.
Well, you don't have it. You never have a jury trial with an infraction, as you know, because they give up their power theoretically to put you in jail, though they can do it. Anyway, in other circumstances. But, I think it's you can give up your jury trial right in a misdemeanor to be tried by a commissioner or even a referee, such as Basket was for a while, if you agree to that. But you can't insist on the right to be tried by a jury. I don't think. But if you find that, I will be very happy because that will stop these prosecutions.
You're certainly right that in an infraction proceeding, you don't get a jury. My question was, and this is one that I'll have to...
Do research it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I will research it, but I do remember something about consent, that something is an infraction. But you know what? I'll have to double
I will that. Double your salary, of course, for this.
I'm not worthy.
Well, it's always. So I think, you know, that we've covered a lot of this. There's other stuff I'd like to talk to you about, perhaps maybe in a subsequent show, if I could prepare it in a concise way that ordinary people could follow and would be interested in following. You know, the problem for me is always that it really boils down to a lot of power considerations rather than any objective standards or fairness in court, or it has to do with, you know, whether... Well, for us, it has to do with whether the city attorney decides to put his resources behind prosecuting you, because that's what happened in our case. City attorneys aren't supposed to really... Well, it's unusual for city attorneys to come in on the side of infraction prosecutions. Usually the police officer just comes in, makes a statement, and the judge makes a decision based on that, if you actually have what's called a court trial. But look, Mark, Mike, not Mark, you two are very confusing. Thank you for coming on the air. Any final thoughts on this before we go?
Yeah, all I can say is aside from video, I think the other thing is people have got to get their complaints and concerns, if not to an attorney, at least to activists like you. Because what's really hard is that if people don't know that this has got to be reported in order to do something about it. You know, so it doesn't help for people to be rushed off the street and say, well, I just, you know, the city of Santa Cruz is not too friendly. But then they never go and document it, and they think something's going to change. I mean, you know, it's kind of a, you know, the system has a right to expect that those who are unhappy will, in a mature, calm fashion, document their unhappiness. I mean, that's a reasonable requirement that I think the system has.
Are they
going to do it?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a good suggestion. You know, I'd never heard about William Hampsmeyer's case until I read about... I heard, you know, the Friday night that the court decision came down a week ago. And I guess, you know, we had a very high-profile case. I mean, we were publicizing it. We went to city council meetings. We published it. Of course, we didn't have much... It wasn't religiously oriented, but it had to do with the same law and the same issues. Was there any coverage of the Hampsmeyer case in the Sentinel or in any of the media at any time prior to this decision?
Oh, certainly no, not prior. I mean, after it came out, you know, KSBW, you know, did a little piece on it, and I appeared on that.
Played that on the air, actually, here. The audio part.
Okay. But no, before this, listen, these cases get filed, and they are... I think the media considers them dog bites man. I mean, nobody picks up a newspaper to find out that a dog bit a man. You know, but when the man bites the dog, that's news.
For sure.
So you have to wait till you get a success. Otherwise, they just assume it's a very typical, boring story of a dog biting.
Yeah, but actually, not so much the media. I was thinking more in terms of, although I asked you that question, is, you know, did you or did William seek out whether there are any other cases? So one of the things we did was, I think I mentioned to you in a phone call, we got a list of all the unreasonably disturbing noise citations. Did you go after any of the background on that? And
I didn't. Okay, here's the thing. When you file a motion for summary judgment, even if you lose, you still are going to get a trial. You know, and so because of that, going to the next level of doing kind of deeper statistical analysis, because, you know, these are hard things to show. I mean, there's no question about it. Seemed like, okay, now wait a minute. Before we go to all that work, let's see if there's so many things we don't like about this law. I bet you the judge will agree with us on at least one thing. And if that's the case, we'll have accomplished the goal for today. Now, tomorrow we may have a different goal, but we'll accomplish today's goal. And that's what happened.
So
to answer your question, no, we never undertook the deep statistical analysis, but that's probably what's going to be next.
Right. Or did you actually go to find out if anybody else had this problem downtown? I mean, we put out sort of a call for that in our case, and we found some people who had, but we didn't hear about William. So I'm glad that somebody did and took the case to court and won.
And again, I've been doing, you know, I've been litigating some of these, you know, cases against Santa Cruz for 10 or 12 years, up to 3 or 4, I can't remember, every so often. So I had a bit of my own bank of, you know, I didn't need to go outside of the office to figure out that they were doing this 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So because of that, it's like, okay, you know, this is enough to meet the threshold of today. The concern you always have in free speech cases is that a police officer, the city is going to distance itself from the police officer and say the police officer was a rogue. And so then the city says, listen, he was having a bad day, he did something crazy, you know, we never knew. And so because I had evidence that they knew, I didn't need to show they, you know, they've done it 50 times, I just need to show they've done it a couple times. That was plenty.
Hmm. So if you can at some point, if you give your clients permission, I'd love to know who these folks were and how things turned out for them, and if they still feel Santa Cruz is, if it's become a more welcome environment for them to do what they need to do and what they were originally banned or harassed for doing, you know.
Well, it's funny, you know, to say that. It's like to say that it's welcome or not welcome. I mean, there's just a bunch of isolated experiences. You go out, something happens. It's not until you look at some statistics that you can figure out whether it's more welcome or not.
No, I'm asking if it's welcome to them. I'm wondering, do they feel more welcome? Have they come back? Do they feel, you know, or have they in fact been deterred? Has their free speech subsequently been chilled? Is William going to come back and do this here, or is he going to, you know, think twice before he walks into Santa Cruz because he knows, yeah, the old law was overturned, but we got the same old shit back again, and it's even tighter than before because you can't use that argument about lawful
activity.
Well,
I got to tell you, I'm not too worried about William Hampsmeyer because I think at this point, what I always encourage the police to do, and I'm glad we have police to keep the peace. I mean, that's not the issue. What I always encourage the police to do is if you think there's a crime, write it up, get some video, and send it over to the district attorney. And that way you can never get sued. That's what I tell police. You can never get sued. If the district attorney decides to prosecute, it's not your fault. If the district attorney drops it, it's not your fault. You just did an investigation and nothing more. And it would be so simple, but instead the police feel like they have to make it right now in their mind, and they sometimes are precipitate.
Yep.
That's what makes it tricky.
That's right. Now, actually, I have personal experience with that, but now's not the time to go into that. Mike, thank you for taking the time to call in, and thanks for, you know, you're going beyond your time. You were only going to do some time earlier in the day, and now you're here at 5 after 1, so...
Hey, no problem. It's good talking to you, and I appreciate the ability to talk about Mr. Hampsmeyer's case.
Sure, if you can, you know, send me the stuff that you sent Barisoni, and if your clients are amenable, I'd love to hear how they've been doing since in Santa Cruz, because that's really what the issue. Can people go on the streets and speak out on issues of this kind and, you know, do so without fear of arrest and without fear of harassment? That's really what my gig is, so...
You bet. All right. Well, good talking to you.
Thank you, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And that kind of brings us close to the end of the show. I'm looking over my notes, see if there's anything. I do have one more person I want to call before I leave, and we'll see if we can get this guy on the line. And then I will be wending my way to Occupy Santa Cruz for a General Assembly that they had. I apologize for not playing the stuff from the Friday shindig that we had. I'm giving a call now to Steve Schnarr, who has been trying to make sure that the bikes the police department takes as abandoned or otherwise... we ain't got him. Hey, Steve, this is Robert at Free Radio, and if you catch this in the next minute and a half... before 1:10, give me a call at the station. I've got time for a little bit of talk. Otherwise, we'll try to discuss it later at another time, maybe on Thursday when I come back at 6 o'clock in the evening. So, he's not around, or who knows what's cooking. But what I did hear is that the bike church, which was cut off from getting bikes from the police department through a peculiar process that seemed to involve Hillary Bryant and Lieutenant Hernandez. I hope I have the right lieutenant there. And various other unnamed city officials, and may have involved routing bikes to allied business interests inappropriately, although there's some dispute about that, and involving the bike dojo and so forth instead of the bike church. Bike church was given at least one load of bikes, the bike dojo, and I'm not sure if they're cooperating now. I think they just couldn't find it. They couldn't distribute them properly, in spite of the police department's determination that they were a more responsible group than the bike church, as I understand it. And so now there's, for the first time, the city assistant city manager, I think. I think that's Tricia. It's not Tricia Houston. It's, boy, there was this Scott guy who's apparently one of the assistant city manager. Maybe old Martine Brunel has a lot of them. I don't know. Anyway, we'll hopefully get an update on what's going on with those bikes on Thursday. Give you more of an update on what's going on in the, whether there's likely to be any settlement in the Heil Krohn City Council repression mock Nazi salute case, which is coming up for trial on October 29th. One thing I am going to try to do before I go is talk with Linda LeMaster very briefly, because Linda does have a trial coming up, and she's actually she's coming up before my lawsuit against the Santa Cruz City Council, which is coming up at the end of the month. Hers is coming up on October 15th, so let's see if she's around. Maybe we can talk to her briefly.
Hello?
Hey, Linda LeMaster.
Hey, Robert North. Hear ya.
Yeah, you're on the radio, so watch what you say. I know that you might want to talk to me. I'm about to go off the air, so there isn't much time. And I know you may be concerned about not making statements that would incriminate you, you sign-holding sleepy girl, for...
Yes, I promised my lawyer I wouldn't...
You promised your lawyer. Fuck your lawyer, forgive me, I'm sorry. I like Jonathan Gettleman, he's a nice guy, but I don't... I don't have a lot of respect for these, what do they call it, gag orders. But nonetheless, whatever you feel best. Is there anything you'd like to say?
I respect it, but I'm still me.
You certainly are.
I guess what I want to say is that on the 15th, the week from tomorrow, when the lodging trial against me left from peace camp 2 years ago starts, it'd be good if people were there to keep an eye on the judge.
And that's going to be at in Department 2, Judge Gallagher's court at again, what time?
At 9 a.m.
And that's when jury selection?
701 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I'd like to apologize. I put out a flyer at the Friday Occupy, which, as you noticed, inaccurately cites your trial as October 9th, which is not. October 9th is when Cameron Lorando goes for a motion to dismiss in the Santa Cruz 11 case, and that's in Department 6, for those who want to check that out day after tomorrow. Again, Department 6, Cameron Lorando, Santa Cruz 11, no, he wasn't guilty of vandalizing, no, he wasn't even guilty of trespassing. Dismiss the charges, let's get on with the next bit of business. You, on the other hand, are clearly a guilty woman for holding signs and things of that sort, which we know in Santa Cruz is only permitted if you get your signs okayed first by the appropriate people. Why didn't you do that, Linda?
I thought Santa Cruz was under the same umbrella of the First Amendment that I still think the rest of the country has.
Well, the rest of the country has a lot...
Local policies are in error.
No. It has its faith in our friend Obama the Bomber, who has decided that certain kinds of things qualify you for a special unprivileged enemy belligerent status, which will, shall we say, detain you, indefinitely for charges that are rather unclear. But that's currently the law, so you better pay attention or it will pay attention to you.
Yes. So our government and its handlers want us all to be afraid all the time. And I don't think we should let our fear interfere with our integrity. So I was at Peace Camp. Yes, I was.
Peace Camp 2010. There's a lot of information about that online at peacecamp2010.blogspot.com. And then, of course, you've written a lot about it at your Hearth by Linda website, which people can find.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Becky Johnson, One Woman Talking, has also done that. And Ed Fry, who's currently under house arrest for his involvement with Peace Camp, has his own Full Spectrum Democracy website. Everybody's got a website except me.
Yeah.
I guess Huff has a website. That's not really my website.
Well, you have a radio show.
But I have a radio show. And then, of course, there's Gary. Indeed. Gary Johnson will be coming out of jail shortly, but he's been in jail for essentially the same thing you've been charged with, 647E, the lodging law. And I'm going to kind of leave it at that unless there's something you want to add.
Yeah. I'm getting nervous as it gets closer. I guess I really had a hard time taking this whole thing very seriously because there was no one hurt or injured in any real sense until they stuck Gary in jail and put Ed under house arrest. I'm starting to try to figure out what I'm missing in this picture.
Well,
so my lawyer's name is Jonathan Gettleman, and he and I deserve everyone's support. And if there are people who are unbusy any part of a week from tomorrow or Tuesday, come watch. It'll help me a lot.
That's Department 2 at 9 a.m. on, is it Monday the 15th? Is that right?
Yes, you got it. Just saying.
A week
Monday
from
the 15th.
It's a week from Columbus Day, or as they call it, I don't know, what, Slaughter the Arawak Day, or something like that?
Indigenous Peoples Day. Let's see if we can save the few who remain.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Linda, and I'll probably be contacting you later on other matters. We want to make sure that you aren't engaging in any further criminal behavior.
Great. Thank you for your call.
All right.
You're so kind.
Thanks. And again, you can also go to Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, to get more information about this case, Linda's case, Gary Johnson's case, Ed Fry's case, all these, essentially a bunch of cases around Occupy Santa Cruz and around Peace Camp 2010. Protests where people tried to engage in direct action and organizing that were crushed as visible activity, but remain as people continue to speak out, as people continue to support those who speak out. And you can come and observe this process in action at the Occupy Santa Cruz today at 2 at the post office steps. That's where it's going to be gathering together. And that's all I got for now. Let's let Sarah Marlowe have her say, and I'll just say goodbye. Coming up after that, we'll be Making Contact and Law and Disorder with, who knows, a few other goodies thrown in. Thanks for listening to this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I may well be at City Council at 3 o'clock on Tuesday to talk about some of these issues. I will probably be at the Cameron Laurendeau's hearing Tuesday morning at 8:15 in the motion to dismiss. Very important because I'm expecting my attorney to make a similar motion at some point, although motion to dismiss usually happens after you've had a preliminary hearing, and I haven't had my preliminary hearing yet. It's in February. I was charged, and here we are in October. My goodness. Yeah. So, and I also will be having a Huff meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with. That's going to be on Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, 703 Pacific. And everybody's invited. You can get coffee if you want. So there. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
The Counterintelligence Program, or COINTELPRO, was a secret FBI project to infiltrate and disrupt domestic organizations thought to be subversive. Between 1956 and 1971, the FBI conducted more than 2,000 COINTELPRO operations, targeting black, brown, Asian, and indigenous movements for self-determination.
If you're involved in radical politics, if you're involved in certain forms of even civil disobedience, that you might be charged as a terrorist in this particular country.
On this edition, part two of the documentary film COINTELPRO 101, produced by the Freedom Archives. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people vital ideas, and important information.
The Black Panther Party was only a small manifestation of what this infrastructure wanted to do.
Geronimo Pratt, Black Panther Party and former political prisoner.
I'm talking about SNCC, came up with these brilliant ideas, you know, that had nothing to do with a Huey Newton or a Bobby Seale. We were organizing in the South, in the West, in the East, the symbol of the Panther from the Mississippi Freedom and Democratic Party, Fannie Lou Hamer, all these people I knew I'm growing up with, we see.
If you're right, you have to stand on that principle, and if it's necessary to die on the principle, because I am sick of the racist war in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United States.
The militant aspects is it's already there from the deacons on. This is what you did. We grew up in a black nation, a nation that had to protect itself.
We are concerned about the survival of black people in this country, and that we cannot survive if we go fight some yellow man in Vietnam who ain't never called us nigger.
The government saw it as a black Marxist movement growing in the North.
Muhammad Ahmad, Revolutionary Action Movement.
We were independent of the Communist Party. We were independent of the Socialist Workers Party. We were independent of all left groups that they had already infiltrated. It was growing.
But you also had the Chicano movement developing, Asian American, anti-imperialist, national liberation consciousness type movement. In the Puerto Rican community, you had the development of that as well as with white students.
Professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University, Akinyele Umoja.
So, you know, in terms of the development of a different type of politics, it scared the hell out of the United States government at that particular moment. And that's why counterinsurgency was developed at that level.
In the past, the poor neighborhoods have been exploited by persons who have been less than American. There's so many of these anti-American, even red organizations.
The FBI and the Department of Justice would learn everything about people in a particular organization.
Attorney Bob Doyle.
And they did that through wiretaps of telephones, of planting bugs in offices, and using informants.
The Red Squad, there are those units within the police department or any law enforcement unit that have as their function the investigating and looking into organizations that perhaps are a little on the suspect side or have revealed themselves in such a way as to be a little bit questionable.
Laura Whitehorn, activist and former political prisoner.
The FBI broke into our houses. And you would know this because you would come home and you could tell your house had been broken into. Door was locked. Nothing was taken except for maybe some papers. But things were rearranged.
Black Panther Party member and attorney Kathleen Cleaver.
The FBI had a way of classifying people who were in the Black Panther Party in many categories, one of which was called the Key Agitator Index. Those are the people who they targeted to be neutralized.
Constitutional rights were not a consideration. They were, in fact, secretly and unilaterally suspended by the FBI, with at least the tacit approval of high officials in the federal government.
Ward Churchill, Native American activist and author.
For purposes of neutralizing, that's a term that was used within the program itself by those FBI officials who were responsible, neutralized the political activities that were considered objectionable on the part of the Bureau undertaken by U.S. citizens.
Gee, why don't I just have one of my informants in another organization go out and shoot this guy and make it look like some kind of a mixed up drug operation.
Wesley Swearingen, former FBI special agent.
And, you know, have him assassinated. That'll neutralize him for sure.
At approximately 2:45 p.m. this afternoon, two men were murdered at the UCLA campus.
At UCLA, you had Bunchy Carter, Alprentice Carter, who was basically the head of the Los Angeles chapter of the Black Panther Party, along with another Panther named John Huggins, who was a key organizer down there, killed by federal undercover personnel, basically, in a classroom at University of California, Los Angeles. This was in Campbell Hall. And, you know, it was just just cold. They were eliminated. The FBI took credit for that result in its internal memoranda.
Wesley Swearingen.
Why don't you first tell me about the agents, the assassination of Carter and Huggins in Los Angeles, and everything like that. Yeah, sure. But I found out later that he wasn't just joking with me. It was true from looking at the file.
Had to do with a disinformation campaign in order to set two political organizations, both of which had been infiltrated, at odds with one another, creating context in which instance certain of the infiltrators could eliminate bona fide activists on the other side. You then have the FBI agent in charge, a guy by the name of Richard Wallace Held, who now runs security for the Visa Corporation. Agent Held talked about how successful the operation had been, and on that basis sought approval for it to be continued. The approval was given. You then have two more Panthers who were killed in San Diego.
And I said, those aren't the only two assassinations. I said, and two in Chicago.
Most famously, perhaps, and best documentedly, have the Hampton-Clark assassinations. Fred Hampton, deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party.
We didn't talk about a Breakfast for Children program. We've got one. We're not going to tell you how many kids we intend to feed and feed in Chicago. We're feeding 3,000 to 4,000 every week already, and I don't know how many all around the country.
And Mark Clark, who was defense captain for a downstate chapter in Peoria, who was staying in the apartment rented by Mr. Hampton on the 4th of December, 1969, when the FBI caused a police arms raid to be executed on the premises, result of which, and this is the cleanest version of it, is that Mr. Hampton and Mr. Clark were shot to death by the police.
And the cops lied about it.
Laura Whitehorn.
And state's attorney Edward Hanrahan lied about it, and he was clearly in on it. It came out. The family proved it. They did that to decapitate the movement.
We said even before this happened. And we're going to say it after this, not that I'm locked up, not that everybody's locked up, that you can jail revolutionaries, but you can't jail a revolution. Right. You might run a liberator like Harris Cleve out the country, but you can't run liberation out the country. You might murder a freedom fighter like Bobby Hutton, but you can't murder freedom fighting. And if you do, you come up with answers that don't answer, explanations that don't explain. You come up with conclusions that don't conclude. Nothing's more important than stopping fascism, because fascism will stop us all.
The government wanted to wipe out the Panthers and the Young Lords later, and the American Indian movement, and Weatherman and other parts of the white progressive movements, because they saw that there was something that was in flames, and they wanted to put it out. And the easiest way to put it out was counterinsurgency. In the United States, the government isn't supposed to use counterinsurgency against its own citizens.
Black Panther Party member Joan Byrd.
Pigs' lives have become so extremely outlandish that they were forced to resort to their ultimate weapon, force, organized force, murder, and brutality against black people. And the attacks against the Black Panther Party escalated. The very night, January 17, 1969, that I was being tortured, Bunchie Carter and John Huggins were shot by the flunkies of this government.
Bob Doyle.
There were numerous false arrests and prosecutions where people spent long time in prison on trumped-up charges.
On April 2nd of 1969, I was rearrested along with 21 other members of the Black Panther Party on charges of conspiracy to murder some pigs, and attacks against our party still escalated.
For example, there was the Panther 21 case in New York where the leadership was basically arrested, spent 2 years in jail before they were acquitted on all charges. But as a result, the New York chapter was virtually decimated.
It was
Geronimo Pratt.
4 days after they murdered Fred Hampton in this bed in Chicago, they shot at me in the bed and tried to do the same thing.
Kathleen Cleaver.
One of the key agitators and one of the targets to be neutralized that was very important to them was a young Vietnam vet who had come to Los Angeles to study. He went to college at UCLA on the GI Bill. His name was Elmer Geronimo Pratt. And he seemed to have been targeted very, very early on.
Wesley Swearingen.
I mean, the FBI had gotten rid of Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, and now they got Geronimo Pratt, who took their place. And they got to get rid of him.
COINTELPRO had an intense interest in the Los Angeles Black Panthers, and at a certain point, the LAPD SWAT team attacked the office front on, just cleared the streets and started shooting. Geronimo had taught people how to fortify the office, and they tried to bomb the office, and it had been sandbagged, and so that didn't work. And eventually, people surrendered. Then they really hated Geronimo because they felt that he had frustrated their desire to destroy the office.
Geronimo was not a violent person. He definitely was not. That was the thing that bugged the FBI. So if they had already worked, you know, two assassinations, the third one might have been a charm, and they might have been discovered. So they worked out something else, which was just as effective. They got him in jail for 25 years.
They put a murder on me that they were able to manipulate in such a way that it stuck. A murder that would keep me a life sentence.
I was on the squad. I know he was framed.
Liz Darius.
FBI documents later revealed that their own surveillance placed Geronimo in Oakland at the time of the murders, not in Los Angeles.
Gene Hamilton was a juror in Geronimo Pratt's case.
I don't think there's any doubt that the decision would have been different if we had the amount of information that is available now. We had no clue as to what the government could do or what they did do. Even though Vietnam was going on, you couldn't believe that your government was doing that at home to one of its own citizens, not only one of its own citizens, one of its own veterans.
And they really put that together in such a way that anything that we did to try to bring out the truth was already preempted, you know. So this is what they used to keep me in prison for 27 years and to criminalize our revolutionary positions.
The whole basis of its political activity, the activity that disturbed the government, that disturbed the status quo,
Ward Churchill,
had been essentially neutralized. He was unable to do that, so the mission was accomplished. That was a successful operation.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to part two of Freedom Archives COINTELPRO 101.
In the investigation conducted by the United States Senate Committee on Intelligence with respect to governmental operations, short term is the Church Committee.
Kathleen Cleaver.
They said, I think it was 235 separate actions of COINTELPRO were targeted against the Black Panther Party. So, you know, every chapter that was of any substance was subjected to this. And there are people who've lost their lives, there are people who've lost their mind, there are people who were completely hostile to anything to do with the Black Panthers because they were abused.
The only reason why I'm here is I disappeared for
Muhammad Ahmad.
You know, many of my comrades have fallen, you know, apartments broken into. Some had security apartments and been found handcuffed to the chair and shot in the back of the head. So it's a continuum of disruption, or what they call destabilization. Just like they destabilize nations, they're destabilizing the entire radical movement one way or another.
COINTELPRO was a highly secret program, and its crimes might not have been exposed were it not for a group of anti-war activists in Pennsylvania.
April of 1971, some anti-war activists,
Bob Doyle,
broke into the FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, which also housed the offices of the Selective Service Administration. And this was a time when there was still a draft. And the goal of these activists was to break in, open the drawers, and burn Selective Service records, draft cards, to keep people from getting drafted. So they broke into this office,
started opening up the file cabinets, and lo and behold, it was an FBI office, and they saw documents entitled Counterintelligence Program, Black Nationalist Hate Groups. And they started reading these documents, took them, didn't burn them, thank goodness, and gave them to the press.
In addition, at least three domestic subversive targets were the subject of numerous entries from October 1952 to June 1966.
Members of the press did their own investigations, which ultimately then led to, in the mid-1970s, an investigation by Senator Frank Church, which became known as the Church Committee, which conducted an investigation into all aspects of government misconduct and surveillance of political organizations in the 50s, 60s, and the 70s.
Senator Frank Church.
We're dealing also with the FBI, a law enforcement agency in this country. And if the law enforcement agencies that are charged with enforcing the law don't themselves obey the law, then who will? Our problem with the CIA has not had to do with its foreign operations, but has had to do with the violations of the law, which says that the CIA stays out of the domestic affairs of the United States. There was a real purpose for that. The purpose was trying to preserve a free society and not let an intelligence agency in the name of national security begin to erode away the foundations of freedom in our own land.
What you see is the government taking it upon itself the supervision of what is allowed politically and what is not allowed politically. And when those decisions are made by essentially an organization that's a political police force, such as the FBI, or intelligence agencies like the CIA or the Department of Defense Intelligence, when those kind of people are making decisions of what is politically appropriate for the citizens to do, then we don't have a democracy. Then we have essentially a police state, because the police are deciding what can happen. And so that's the fundamental crime of the COINTELPRO program.
Whether there's stress or turbulence doesn't really excuse agencies, law enforcement agencies of the government, or the president himself from rising above the law and proceeding in lawless fashion.
The FBI admitted.
Jose Lopez, Puerto Rican Cultural Center.
To the Congress of the United States, that they had over 1 million documents on the Puerto Rican independence movement. 1 million documents on a movement of a very small island. And it speaks to how important the COINTELPRO program has been vis-a-vis the Puerto Rican independence movement.
They actually intensified with a lot of money their attacks, which largely
Geronimo Pratt
are comprised of illegal tactics to make the criminal the victim and the victim the criminal, to turn everything around. So we couldn't win the hearts and minds of the people if we wanted. So we will begin to be looked upon as the enemies of the people instead of what we were. Freedom fighter, fighting for people.
So they're using mind games, manipulation, deceit to create confusion, dissension, and end up destroying the leadership. I was in the middle of that, and I would say that the repercussions of that kind of COINTELPRO operation are still present.
Whether the death of Ricardo Falcón was an assassination.
Priscilla Falcón, professor of Hispanic Studies at the University of Northern Colorado.
Or not. It had a very chilling effect on social movements, on communities not only in Colorado, not only in the community that he was born in, but in communities across the United States, across the Southwest. It said to people, if you dare to go out into community and begin to make social change, then you are going to have to pay a heavy price for that.
No one was ever punished for the illegal activities of government agencies under the COINTELPRO programs. Some people paid a high price for fighting back or resisting this government-led war against progressive movements. George Jackson was one of the black movement leaders targeted by COINTELPRO for assassination in prison. And some people are still paying a high price. Those who are political prisoners. Those who remain locked up some 20, 30, and 40 years later. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former Black Panther who continues to write and broadcast radio commentaries after decades of unjust imprisonment.
Many of us have been part of national liberation movement, revolutionary political parties, anti-racist communes, or, in the case of people like the Cuban Five, anti-terrorism activists. We've been tried in tribunals where our politics have been our crime, and our political associations our felonies. We need a movement of millions to bring freedom to the brothers and sisters of the Move 9, to bring freedom to Sundiata Akoli, to bring freedom to Mutulu Shakur, and hundreds of other political prisoners. We need a movement of millions to make common cause with oppressed people the world over.
Attorney Bob Doyle.
COINTELPRO is happening today on many different levels and is a lot more sophisticated. And in fact, it doesn't need to be a secret anymore.
I believe that it is our ability,
Jose Lopez,
to transform that repression into meaningful discussion. Because it's not just about us saying, well, we need to take the state head on. It is also to engage people in reflections in their homes, in everywhere, to think about not what historically has been done because of COINTELPRO, what is being done right now? How is COINTELPRO really the rubric for the Patriot Act and many aspects of Homeland Security?
Ricardo Romero, Alfrente de Lucha.
If it was COINTELPRO then, it's probably COINTELPRO now. Maybe a different version or a different name. The same practice is to eliminate, intimidate, incarcerate, and terrorize a people.
Kathleen Cleaver.
Certain kinds of searches that were illegal or unconstitutional, now under Patriot Act, they can be done.
Akinyele Umoja.
If you're involved in radical politics, if you're involved in certain forms of even civil disobedience, that you might be charged as a terrorist in this particular country.
In Puerto Rico, there is, I believe, a growing movement to really understand the role of the FBI, particularly with the assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios.
The FBI pursued Rios, an independence movement leader, for 15 years after he failed to appear for sentencing on robbery charges. On September 23, 2005, the FBI murdered him during an assault on his home in Puerto Rico.
That led many people to really question the role of the FBI.
Ward Churchill.
What they call this great green scare of the last few years, the radical environmental movement, for lack of a better term, this was showcased as being an example of so-called domestic terrorism, although I don't know that it's ever been shown they hurt anyone. Now the people who are the most serious, most principled activists are in a position of being made into examples of the cost and consequence. Disproportionately harsh, ridiculous sentences, if you want to think about it, under the rubric of terrorism.
Now, under the Patriot Act, there doesn't even have to be any crime. People can just be investigated. And guess what? They get investigated because of their politics. They get put on lists. They get under surveillance. There's all kinds of things that happen to people. They can be whisked off into prisons that no one even knows where they are. They can be tortured. They can be brutalized. These are the things that were being done under COINTELPRO as well. But the government said they weren't happening because they were illegal. They could have been charged for violating the law. But now, that is the law.
Muhammad Ahmad.
There are young people looking for answers. And there are enough victims of COINTELPRO around from the 60s and 70s in every community to warn young people of the traps.
Chicano and Mexicano activist and attorney Francisco Martinez.
There are yet people who have raw wounds walking around from those years. And as long as those wounds don't heal, and as long as society doesn't let them heal, there will be another generation who sees those wounds and will take those wounds personally and will make the future revolutionaries who will, we hope, link up someday to people from the other continents who are also oppressed and maybe make for a little improvement.
The organized resistance and claims for social and human justice, for political democracy, for economic democracy have to go into the forefront, and we have to have broader and broader coalitions and stronger movements, and it has to make a political impact. And so we cannot just say, well, because it's hard, we can't do it. No, it has to be done. It is a long and protracted struggle, but you cannot abandon it, and you have to recognize, as James Forman always said, we will win without a doubt.
The quest for freedom, the quest for equality, and the quest for community. And I think that that's something that systems of greed and oppression try to deny, and I think we have a right, or more important, our responsibility to take those things head on and to be part of building movements of resistance.
Ultimately, the only safety that we will be able to secure and pass along to our coming generations is not only to confront the nature of the reality reflected in COINTELPRO and comparable sorts of operations from Homeland Security or whoever, but to dismantle the system that gives rise to them and replace it with something that would actually reflect our interests, that would reflect concern with our well-being, and reflect a certain sort of respect for the dignity of our communities, our traditions, and us as individuals.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Freedom Archives. To hear a full-length version of the film or find out if it's being screened in your local community, go to our website, radioproject.org. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.